mean? And why do politicians need to say it every 5 minutes?
Exploring the verbal tricks of the trade.
And the effect it has on the rest of us.
Strong Message Here starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Tomorrow morning at 9:45.
On FM, on digital and on BBC Sounds, this is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 23rd of October. Good morning. This is Today with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb.
Good morning. The headlines today. Donald Trump's campaign team has accused the Labour Party of illegal foreign interference in the US presidential election. A review of the UK's water industry is to consider the future of the regulator, Ofwat, but not renationalisation. And we'll be speaking to the Environment Secretary, because we'll also be returning to the River Avon, where volunteers have taken to testing the water themselves.
We had some awful results, some of the worst that we've had in a long time. I got really sick when I swam after a rainy day. Oh my gosh!
And also in today's programme, the vaccine, which could protect us against that scourge of winter, the norovirus, the vomiting bug, and...
My concept for that piece was to take phrases that the orchestra play and put them on the turntables. And we even start to wonder what's turntables, what's orchestra.
It's Prokofiev, but not as you know it, why Sergei's grandson Gabriel has written a concerto for turntables, the BBC News has read this morning by Charles Carroll.
Donald Trump's presidential campaign has taken the extraordinary step of filing a legal complaint against the Labour Party, accusing it of blatantly interfering in the American election. The 6-page letter cites a now-deleted social media post in which Labour members were encouraged to travel to the US to campaign for the Democrats. In a statement, Mr. Trump's team claims the party has inspired what it calls Kamala Harris's dangerously liberal policies and rhetoric. Sir Keir Starmer says Labour activists were volunteering in their own time. Our political editor, Chris Mason, has more details.
The complaint from the Trump campaign is both pointed and theatrical. When representatives of the British government previously sought to go door-to-door in America, it did not end well for them. A matter-of-fact reference to US independence around 250 years ago. To matters more contemporary, it requests an immediate investigation into what it calls blatant foreign interference. Sir Keir Starmer said Labour had volunteers who'd gone to America pretty much every election, and they were doing it in their spare time and staying with other volunteers. Asked if it risked jeopardising his relationship with Donald Trump, he said no, pointing to the dinner the two men had together at Trump Tower in New York last month. We established a good relationship, the Prime Minister said.
Britain and Germany will today sign what the government's calling a landmark defence agreement aimed at boosting security, investment and jobs. Under the plans, the German defence company Rheinmetall will open a new factory in the UK to produce barrels for artillery guns. German maritime surveillance aircraft will also fly patrols from RAF Lossiemouth in Scotland. Our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale, reports.
The UK already has a defence pact with France, but this is the first with Germany. The Defence Secretary, John Healey, called it historic, bringing the UK and German militaries closer together. In reality, Germany and the UK already cooperate as NATO allies and in a joint venture that already making new armoured vehicles for the British Army. But the German defence giant Rheinmetall will also build a factory in the UK to manufacture barrels for artillery guns. It'll use British steel and support 400 jobs.
A BBC investigation has found that Russia has expanded its recruitment of prisoners to fight in the war in Ukraine. The scheme now includes people who are in detention awaiting trial, as well as those who've been convicted. Olga Ivshina reports.
Some of the stories of the violent Russian criminals killed in Ukraine are notorious. Men who burned people alive or stabbed their own mother. But our investigation shows how Russia has expanded its recruitment to much lower category prisons, including those in pre-trial detention centers. A new law introduced earlier this year obliges both prosecutors and defense lawyers to offer military contracts to almost anyone accused of a crime in Russia.
The Israeli military says it's confirmed the death of a senior Hezbollah figure who was expected to take over as leader after Hassan Nasrallah was killed in September. Israeli officials said an attack on the Lebanese capital, Beirut, earlier this month had eliminated Hashim Sufyadin. His death has not been confirmed by Hezbollah. An independent commission is being set up to look at how to improve the UK's troubled water industry. The review, described as the sector's biggest since its privatisation in the 1980s, will be led by Sir John Cunliffe, the former Deputy Governor of the Bank of England. More details from our business editor, Simon Jack.
Government officials say all options are on the table for the new commission, including the reform or abolition of current regulators, including Ofwat. All options, that is, apart from nationalisation, which the government insists would cost taxpayers billions and take years. That means the money to fix the UK's crumbling infrastructure will ultimately have to come from higher customer bills. The government has already announced plans to get tough on water companies, including higher consumer compensation for problems and possible criminal liability for company directors if they don't cooperate with greater scrutiny.
A vaccine which protects against the winter vomiting bug norovirus is to be tested by thousands of adults in the UK. If the trials are successful, experts say the vaccine could reduce the huge burden on the NHS caused by the effects of the easily spreadable virus. Here's our health reporter, Philippa Roxby.
Norovirus causes vomiting and diarrhoea. Every year in the UK, it's the cause of 80 deaths and 12,000 hospital admissions, and costs the NHS £100 million. The mRNA vaccine being trialled, made by Moderna in a collaboration between the UK government and the National Institute for Health and Care Research, targets three of the most common strains of norovirus. It will be tested on around 25,000 people, mostly over 60, in more than six countries around the world over the next 2 years.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, says she's reached spending agreements with all government departments after ministers raised concerns about the scale of cuts expected to be outlined in next week's budget. Sources said there was significant angst across government. Speaking to the BBC, Ms. Reeves said it was perfectly reasonable for ministers to argue their case, but she had to make difficult decisions.
You can't just sort of pretend that the sort of fiscal position that we've inherited is all fine and there won't be any pain in fixing it. And I'm not going to pretend otherwise. I'm not going to say that all of those problems can just be magicked away.
And after 6 days in Australia, the King and Queen are due to arrive in Samoa. The couple will spend 3 days on the Pacific Island. They'll be welcomed with a traditional Samoan ceremony where the King is expected to be given the honorary title of High Chief.
Thank you. 7 minutes past six. Let us have our first look at the weather. Comes this morning from Simon King. Morning, Simon.
Morning, Justin. It's fog this morning that we've got to be careful of across some central, eastern and southern areas of England. And it's going to be pretty dense. Visibility is lower than 100 metres, for example, in parts of the Midlands and eastern England at the moment. Now, while the fog will lift up into some low cloud fairly early on, there will be some patches remaining into late morning, especially around Lincolnshire and East Anglia. We've also got a few showers around the English Channel coasts in the southeast, but there'll be some sunny spells developing for most into the afternoon. Still, the continued risk of one or two showers around southern areas of England and temperatures about 15 to 17 degrees. For Wales, northwest and northeast England, again, one or two mist and fog patches, but not quite as extensive or as widespread as elsewhere. We'll see those fog patches clearing and there'll be some sunshine for most, a bit of cloud at times and the small possibility of a shower in northwest England, highs of 12 to 14 degrees. And then for Scotland and Northern Ireland, a bit more cloud around, especially in northern and western areas of Scotland, where there'll be some patches of rain today, some sunny spells, temperatures generally 12 to 14 degrees, but perhaps up to 17 around the Murray Firth.
Thanks very much, Simon. Let's have a look then at 8 minutes past six at the morning papers, the front pages, the websites, what's making the agenda across various outlets. Let's go to the Times first, which reports that Metropolitan Police Commissioner Sir Mark Rowley wants officers to be exempt from criminal charges unless prosecutors can show that they deliberately departed from their training. The call comes after the firearms officer, Martin Blake, was cleared of the murder of Chris Cabber on Monday. The Guardian says the National Police Chiefs Council is also calling for similar changes. But the paper says campaigners have criticised such moves as a cynical attempt by police leaders to secure effective immunity for officers.
According to the Telegraph, what's described as the most effective drug for Alzheimer's is set to be blocked for use on the NHS. The paper says regulators are expected to declare that the treatment, which is donanemab, is safe for use, but the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence is expected to rule it's too expensive for NHS patients in what is expected to be a blow for campaigners.
A couple of the papers have picked up on research which suggests that the high cost of living may be playing a role in the return of scurvy. The Eye says doctors have written in the British Medical Journal about one case caused by a dietary lack of vitamin C when treating a middle-aged man. The Times quotes the author of the report saying that scurvy is seen as a disease of the past, but that in some cases the rising cost of living is making it harder for some to afford good quality, nutritious food.
The Guardian says ABBA's Björn Ulvaeus, Radiohead's Tom York, the actor Julian Moore have joined thousands of musicians, actors and authors to warn about the threats of artificial intelligence in their industries. In an open letter, the group says the unlicensed use of creative works for training generative AI is a major unjust threat to the livelihoods of the people behind those works and must not be permitted.
Many of the papers reflect on the King and Queen's six-day visit to Australia, which wrapped up yesterday. The Times says it ended on a high as more than 10,000 people waited to see the royal couple at the Sydney Opera House. The Daily Mirror says the event marked a turning point in the tour after the King and Queen were heckled earlier on in the trip. The Daily Express focuses on another of their engagements yesterday, the quintessentially Australian activity of a barbecue. Yummy. The paper says the couple were on sizzling form.
And the Telegraph highlights Bernard the Eurasian Black Vulture, who has become the first of his kind to have stem cell treatment to alleviate, arthritis. The 28-year-old bird of prey, who's cared for by the Horseman Vulture Trust in South Wales, has been experiencing stiffness in his leg, but since undergoing the procedure at the start of the month, conservation says movement's improved and that Bernard is much happier wandering around.
Good old Bernard. Right, 11 minutes past six. Let's go to this highly unusual turn of events in which Donald Trump has accused the UK Labour Party of illegally interfering in the US election by helping his opponent Kamala Harris's campaign. A few minutes ago, I caught up with Peter Bowes, our North America correspondent.
It is a strange story because of the nature of the allegation. Maybe I'll just recap what they are saying in this six-page letter to the Federal Election Commission. They're claiming that by sending over volunteers to work with the campaign of Kamala Harris, Labour and the Harris campaign were making or accepting illegal foreign national contributions, blatant foreign interference in the US election, according to Mr. Trump's lawyer. And I'll just talk through some of the detail. The letter cites media reports about contact between Labour and the Harris campaign, quoting, for example, the Washington Post, which it says reported on strategists linked to the Labour Party who'd offered advice to Kamala Harris about how to earn back disaffected voters and run a winning campaign from the centre-left. Not particularly unusual in an election campaign. It suggests in the wake of meetings between them that the Harris campaign has been borrowing language and themes from Labour, with language like, we're not going back and it's time to turn the page. Now, nothing illegal about that, but this is what the Trump campaign takes issue with and has a few people perplexed here. The letter cites a now deleted post on LinkedIn, the networking site, apparently from a senior Labour official, offering 10 spots on a trip to the US during which the party would, quote, sort housing for volunteers. And the Post says about 100 Labour Party staff, current and former, are heading to America. The Trump campaign says the Post implied that Labour was funding the effort and that would be illegal under US election law.
This is all from the campaign. There's not been a specific statement from Donald Trump.
No, this isn't Donald Trump himself talking, but the Trump campaign. There has been no official statement from the Harris campaign. I should say that on the Labour side, we understand that all the volunteers were just that, not paid for by their efforts, that they would take time off from their usual jobs, travel in their own time, and that they would not be organised or funded by the party.
When we hear foreign interference and the words Donald Trump and the Donald Trump campaign, you know, is this surprising territory?
Well, when we hear foreign interference, I think minds go initially to Russia or China in an American election. I think the surprising thing is that that kind of language is being used by a country that in all other respects is seen as America's best friend. And in fact, Sir Keir Starmer and Donald Trump met very recently, and according to Keir Starmer, they got on very well. That was a very friendly interaction. So to use language as strong as this does seem to be quite unusual.
Peter, thank you very much. Really good to talk to you.
6:15 is the time. It's the Commonwealth Summit in Samoa. Katie Watson is our correspondent who is there already. And it kicks off, doesn't it, soon. And the King is on his way. What are we expected to talk about and to achieve?
Well, yeah, I'm on the runway here in Samoa, and you can probably hear they're practicing the welcome, the ceremonial welcome. There is a cleaner with a vacuum cleaner on the red carpet, so they're very much waiting for the King and Queen to arrive. So this is, I mean, it's the largest event that Samoa has ever hosted. It's the first time it's come to a Pacific island. It's also the first time that the King has attended since becoming monarch. I think, you know, climate change is top of the agenda, both for Chogham, but also for his state visit, which will be on Thursday. So he's visiting a mangrove reserve. He is going to the national park and looking at marine ecosystems. Of course, this is a part of the world, and many Commonwealth members are very vulnerable to climate change with rising sea levels, and that's something that Samoa has said that they want to focus for the next few days here in Samoa.
The other thing that people have talked about being on the agenda is reparations for slavery. Is it on the agenda, and if so, in what form?
So officially, it's not being tabled, I believe, but certainly it's a subject that's bound to come up. The Secretary General, currently Patricia Scotland, there are three candidates to replace her. All of those are from Africa, and they've supported the idea of reparations. I mean, I think that it will come up undoubtedly through this. I mean, this is a time. This is a discussion about Commonwealth, and has a British legacy, colonial legacy. So these issues will absolutely be discussed in some form, even if it is informally.
Katie Watson in Samoa with the carpet cleaners and the band warming up behind her. Thank you.
Yes, it's quite atmospheric, isn't it? 6:16, as the US dollar hits its strongest level in months, is there what's being described as a Trump trade going on amongst investors ahead of the election in a couple of weeks? Sean Farrington has more on that and much more for us. Sean, good morning.
Morning, Gemma. Yeah, nice, clean Salford studio. It's a bit quieter here. Some of these moves on the global markets indicate an increasing number of investor bets that Donald Trump is becoming more likely to win the election. The dollar 4% stronger than it was a few weeks ago. If we look at where it is against the pound, it's at $1.30 this morning. Current strength of the US economy also playing a part in these numbers as well. Alex Stewart is senior fixed income fund manager at Schroders, keeps an eye on these things. Morning, Alex.
Good morning, Sean.
Just focusing on the Trump aspect of all this, or the election aspect, what is the logic? Why would the cost of borrowing for the United States increase if expectations increase for a Trump win?
Well, I mean, it's more if it's Trump with a clean sweep, so he has both houses, because then it's expected that he can enact sort of more contentious policies like his tariff policy, which would obviously have impacts on inflation, and also the cost of borrowing for longer term in the US.
So how do those policy decisions impact inflation and therefore the cost of borrowing?
Well, I mean, it's expected, you know, also that, you know, the tariff trade is one part of it, but I think people are looking back to when he was elected the last time and what happened in terms of being quite aggressively going for growth and not being quite so bothered about, you know, the public debt limits and how much he was borrowing. And obviously that's one of the things that bond markets particularly are concerned about, particularly in terms of the cost of borrowing further out what we call yield curves, so at maturities of sort of 10 years and longer.
Does it feel to you like there's a Trump trade going on? Because we've had official numbers about the US economy lately that have showed it's going pretty strongly.
Yes, I mean, I think it's interesting. Markets seem to be pricing in pretty much in line with the betting markets, which are now moving pretty much in Trump's direction. Actually, when you look at the polls and so on, it is much, much closer. So I don't think it's fully reflected, obviously, because we still don't know what the outcome is going to be. But it's definitely been moving that way.
Alex, thanks so much for the update there. Alex Stewart there from Schroders. Now, the boss of the co-op says that concerned businesses should look at the benefits of stronger workers' rights and look at others who've had some of the new policies like sick pay from day one that are going to be coming in with the new workers' rights bill in place for some time. I spoke to the chief executive of the cooperative group, Shireen Currie-Hack, about the impact of various issues that are on the table ahead of the budget a week today.
You'll know that we've long called for reform of the business rate system, which we believe is fundamentally broken. And you only have to look at our UK high streets to see that it's an issue. For us, our business rates have increased £20 million over the last 2 years. That's 20%, up to £111 million per annum. So we are hoping that the budget will address that in order for us to be able to revitalize our high streets.
And what do you think the best way is to address that? It's been a long talked about issue, the way business rates are calculated.
I think there needs to be protection of bricks and mortar stores, and there needs to be equity in terms of online businesses paying their share of tax as well.
And I just wonder, everybody's sort of looking at potential consequences of policy changes. What would be the biggest change if there was business rate reform?
I think that we would see that some of the businesses that have left the high street hopefully will be coming back. You know, for us, we are the most shopped shop on the retail high street. We have 2.5 million transactions every day, over 800 million transactions per year. So we are absolutely committed to staying on the high street as long as it's affordable for us. But it's important that other businesses are also on the high street so that we have vibrant communities, we have employment opportunities, and hopefully that would be the consequence of it.
And do you see that? Does that become an issue for you as a business? You might not be closing your specific store in a certain place, but there's an impact on your business there.
Well, it's the business, but it's also in terms of our communities. So you'll know we as an organization, we are a member-owned cooperative. So our profits really only go two ways. They go back into investing in our business, or they go out into the communities where our members are. And we absolutely see the impact on communities when you don't have the job opportunities, when young people don't have places to go to, you know, after school or in the holidays. So definitely we see that it would be an improvement.
Having members owning the business, when you see the changes to the employment rights bill, for example, workers' rights and the if we take as an example, getting sick pay, maternity, paternity benefits from day one rather than maybe a few days later. Is that a move in the right direction to go to day one?
We've been on that for some time now. Mm. So when we look at the workers' rights that are being proposed by the government, we're actually encouraged to see that a number of things that we have been doing for some time being put on statutory footing. So you mentioned the day one right to request flexible working arrangements. We've had that for a number of years. We have had productive and constructive relationships with our trade unions for some time. And so we do see it as a benefit. And in fact, we're an organization, because we've had these around for some time, we can evidence the benefit of having these within organizations in terms of the positive impact it has on our colleagues.
What would you say to businesses who are concerned that they are going to have to be changing at the point at which they give those benefits?
To businesses, I would say, you know, do look at other businesses that have been doing this for some time and look at the benefits that they've derived from being able to keep their employees in the workforce and motivated. To the government, I would say, please do consult with business. Please give as much advance warning as possible and work with business to be able to implement this in a considered way.
Mm. Do you think we'd necessarily see, you know, more people calling in sick on day one and that becoming an issue because they could be able to receive sick pay on that day?
Look, I've always worked on the basis that the people that I work with are professionals and they will do the right thing for the organization and for their families. So that has not been our experience at the co-op.
In terms of business taxes, how much will it impact the co-op, do you think, if you have to pay more national insurance, employer contributions, or quite possibly as being talked about on your workers' pensions?
It's in the millions. You know, we're still working that through, but it is a significant impact, as the real living wage increase was as well. Our wage bill increased by about £100 million, you know, just in the real living wage increases. And, you know, for me as a business leader, I have to balance wanting to pay my colleagues absolutely fairly and linking pay to inflation as it should be with how we run our business and how we make sure that we can continue to maintain the profitability that we need.
Does that mean necessarily that staff wouldn't be getting the pay rises they might have without those extra national insurance contributions from the employer, from you?
No, from us, absolutely not the case. They will be getting the pay increases. We have committed to paying the real living wage. The question then becomes how we balance everything else in the business to be able to afford that.
Shireen, thank you very much. Shireen Currie-Hack, Chief Executive of the Cooperative Group. Thank you. 65,000 employees at the Cooperative Group as well, hence those numbers that the boss there talked about. Let's talk overhauls of businesses with Randeep Somal, Fund Manager at M&G Investment Management. Morning, Randeep.
Good morning, Sean.
Bit of a theme this morning in some of the world's biggest businesses. HSBC, for starters, set for a pretty big restructuring, going to split what they do geographically into Eastern and Western markets. How is that particularly different to what they do now and why?
Well, I mean, HSBC is a very big behemoth and it makes most of its profits in Asia. I think the CEO, who's relatively new in the job, George Elegy, has said that he wants the bank to be more agile and dynamic, i.e. regional trends are changing. They need much more deeper relationships with their customers, and they can do that by making the bank more focused. I think he's also conscious that interest rates are starting to come down. They benefited from rising rates on their deposit business. So it's a good opportunity to also take out some costs.
Any concerns, as you know, read a bit about this morning, the reactions to this, that there might be less scrutiny of the operations that they have and the business that they run in China?
No, I mean, I think we've seen this before. Prudential have done something similar where they've split their Asian business from the European businesses. The two have just diverged so much that you need separate management teams having a different focus.
So from one of the world's biggest banks to one of the world's biggest coffee shop companies, Starbucks, shares fallen, sales down, or at least the amount of traffic that it gets in its stores is down. And the boss there, the new boss, Brian Nichol, Randeep, saying, we will have to simplify our overly complex menu. That's not a great message to send to potential customers this morning, is it?
No, I mean, across the board globally, Starbucks have seen their same store sales fall 7% and a whopping 14% in China. Prices have risen, the menu have got too complex, customers have bulked, and there's more competition out there today. So they need an overhaul. And now that you have a new CEO, as you say, who's had mastered a very good turnaround at Chipotle, I think his plan is to do something very similar at Starbucks.
What does that mean customers might get?
Well, a more varied menu. I've obviously some cheaper priced products that they're more willing to look at. And also, as they've said, at peak times, the queues are just far too large. So if you simplify the menu, it might help customer throughput.
Randeep, thank you. Randeep Somal there, Fund Manager at M&G Investment Management. So there you go, Justin, Emma, your large venti latte with a hazelnut sprinkle and cream on top might be a bit cheaper in future at Starbucks.
Yes, other coffee shops are available. Thank you, Sean. Let us turn to Mike in the sport.
Justin, thank you. Good morning. Let's start, shall we, in Birmingham this morning, because the villains were the heroes in the Champions League last night.
That is it. Unai Emery heads down.
down the tunnel, applauding the supporters. Aston Villa, 3 wins out of 3 in this Champions League group stage. They are top of this new league format. They are in dreamland, Aston Villa fans. The party starting in B6.
Yes, I'm sure Jeff Beck still ringing out across parts of Birmingham this morning after a third straight victory for Aston Villa on their return to Europe's elite for the first time in over 40 years. They beat the Italian side Bologna 2-0 at a boisterous Villa Park thanks to second half goals from John McGinn and John Duran. It means Unai Emery's team sit top of the Champions League's new consolidated league table, having not conceded a single goal.
It's brilliant, our start in this competition. I am delighted how we are facing in this competition each match. Discipline, serious, important for the group to keep the same mentality, respecting the opponent.
So a great win for Aston Villa. Victory 2 for Arsenal. They beat Shakhtar Donetsk at the Emirates last night. A first half own goal from the Ukrainians, handing Arsenal a 1-0 victory. Result of the night in the Champions League, though, came in Spain, and a stunning comeback from the defending champions. So Real Madrid were 2-0 down to Borussia Dortmund at home in a repeat of last year's final, only for the Brazilian striker, the man you can hear the commentator getting very excited about, Vinicius Junior, who's favourite to win the Ballon d'Or next week. He produced a second-half hat-trick to see Madrid eventually win 5-2 at the Bernabeu, and his third goal in that hat-trick is absolutely sublime. You can watch that on the BBC Sport website from 10 p.m. this evening. In cricket, England captain Ben Stokes says he is fit enough to play a greater role with the ball in his side's deciding test with Pakistan, which starts this time tomorrow. England have picked 3 spinners for that match in Rawalpindi. And finally, Justin, you love all things American. A little bit of parenting history in US sports overnight. I don't know how you would feel about working with your children, but that's what we saw in the NBA. 39-year-old LeBron James and his 18-year-old son, Bronny James, became the first father and son to play in the NBA together overnight during the LA Lakers season open against Minnesota. Would you fancy working with your kids?
No. Plenty of father-son combos in the Premiership rugby.
Yes, true.
Although not on the pitch at the same
time. Yeah, that's the point. This is the first time the father and son have played together.
Yeah. Have they ever played together in rugby? I'm sure people will know and will let us know. We'll bring it up later. Indeed, you could devote an entire sports bulletin.
Perhaps I will.
You're promising to. Thank you very much, Mike.
I have more diamonds than the Queen of England.
Welcome to the world of thieves and hoaxers and con women.
She does sound fabulous, though.
Massive dogs, lots of cars.
But who are these lady swindlers? And did they get away with their frauds and deceptions by using their feminine characteristics?
I am the notorious Tilly Devine.
She's a bit of a one-off, really.
Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley.
Where true crime meets history.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Time now is 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on Radio 4. Emma Barnett and Justin Webb and Charles Carroll with a summary of the news.
Donald Trump's campaign team has accused the Labour Party here of interfering in the US presidential election, following reports that some party activists have been campaigning for Kamala Harris. Sir Keir Starmer said members volunteering for the US Democrats were doing so in their spare time and were not receiving party funding. The former Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, Sir John Cunliffe, is to chair the biggest review of the water industry since it was privatised in the late 1980s. Ministers say the review will pave the way for tougher regulation and boost investment to rebuild the UK's broken water infrastructure. Britain and Germany will today sign what the government's calling a landmark defence agreement aimed at boosting security, investment and jobs. Under the plans, the German arms maker Rheinmetall will open a new factory in the UK to manufacture barrels for artillery guns, supporting 400 jobs. A BBC investigation has found that Russia has expanded its recruitment of prisoners to fight in Ukraine. Those under pressure to sign up for the war now include people in pre-trial detention, accused of minor offences, not just those convicted of brutal crimes. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has told Israeli leaders that much more needs to be done to deliver humanitarian aid to civilians in the besieged area of northern Gaza. Mr. Blinken's comments came as he prepared to leave Tel Aviv to head to the Saudi capital, Riyadh. A vaccine which protects against the sickness bug norovirus is set for large-scale trials in the UK. Experts believe the jab could reduce the huge burden placed on the NHS every year by the fast-spreading virus. And the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, says that she has reached spending agreements with all government departments ahead of next week's budget. Sources said there had been significant angst across the government about the scale of cuts, with some ministers calling for a last-minute rethink. As Reeves told the BBC, there had been difficult decisions to make in her bid to find additional money.
Thank you. It is 26 minutes to seven. How to deal with Donald Trump? The issue bubbles to the surface once again, with Trump's people now complaining, as we were hearing in the news, about Labour, to America's Federal Election Commission, no less. Let's talk to Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. And it all comes, Henry, initially at least, from a post on LinkedIn.
That's right, from a Labour Party official who said that nearly 100 current and former party staff would be heading to campaign in battleground states in America. And she was saying if there are others who wanted to do so, she could help them out. And indeed, she said, we will sort your housing. Now, talking to Labour Party officials, they've not made a formal response, but they say, look, that we was not the Labour Party. This is a Labour sort of network, but it's not the Labour Party deciding to campaign for the Democratic Party. It's Labour people in their spare time helping out a sister party, you know, partly arguably just for the fun of it. Now, as you say, the Trump campaign has said that this is blatant foreign interference, and they've done so in a legal complaint to the Federal Election Commission, the FEC. The FEC's rules are that foreign volunteers for an American political campaign are fine as long as they are not compensated, as long as they are not paid. And speaking on the way to Samoa for a Commonwealth Heads of Government summit, Keir Starmer, that is essentially the defence he's advanced. He said, look, these are volunteers. They go over pretty much every election. They're doing it as volunteers. They're staying with other volunteers. So the position of the government, position of Keir Starmer, is essentially this is no big deal.
And yet the post on LinkedIn has been taken down, doesn't it? This is the post that said we could sort housing for volunteers, which I suppose is the issue then is who's paying for that housing.
Yeah, and I think when Keir Starmer was talking about it, he said, look, I think they're staying with other volunteers. So it sounds like it's imprecise language, but in the view of the Labour Party, nothing more than that. I mean, I think the question here for Keir Starmer is this is clearly awkward for the Labour leadership, which could in less than 2 weeks be dealing with President-elect Trump, of course. But is it merely awkward, or does it threaten that potential relationship between Donald Trump and Keir Starmer, that potential special relationship that they could be the custodians of for the next 4 years or so? The government would hope that all the groundwork they have put in means that this is actually just really a kind of ephemeral row. It is Donald Trump perhaps using the Labour Party as a way to lash out at Kamala Harris, as a way to cast her as left wing. But we will find out. I mean, clearly, the work that Keir Starmer has done getting close to Donald Trump, he had dinner with him in New York a few weeks ago. They would hope that that would bear fruit should Donald Trump win the presidential election. But I think equally, the government would have been hoping that work like that wouldn't result in a row like this.
Henry Zeppan, thank you.
At 23 minutes to 7, let's have a look at what the government's doing closer to home, launching an independent review into the water industry. This is following an outcry from you, from the public, over bills, bonuses and sewage pollution. Simon Jack, our business editor, has more. Simon, what could this hope to do? What do we know of the scale and the scope?
Yeah, well, we had Fergal Sharkey on this programme yesterday saying that it's a chaotic mess, and I think a lot of people would agree with that. It needs root and branch reform. It's going to start having supply problems in providing water for growing populations and could even put a brake on some housing development. So it's a big problem. So that root and branch reform is what this commission promises, a total reset, a commission led by Sir John Cunliffe, formerly the governor of the deputy governor of the Bank of England, is going to look at how the industry is run and regulated. And government officials say all options are on the table, including the reform or the abolition of the current regulator Ofwat. All options, that is, apart from nationalisation, which the government rules out. It said it would cost taxpayers billions, it would take years, in which time the problems would only get worse. And I think that means, that's the crucial thing there, that means that the money to fix this infrastructure will ultimately have to come from higher customer bills. There's a widespread view that weak regulation allowed some investors to take bigger dividends, saddling some companies with unsustainable debts. But it's hard to see, I think, Emma, how the failures of the past won't eventually lead to much higher water bills in the future.
And no nationalisation, as you say, but in terms of, you know, there'll be those who just say getting rid of the regulator, if that's what then happens, that still perhaps won't change the behaviour of the water companies where there has been poor behaviour and mismanagement.
Well, and the government says to that, listen, we've already done a bit of tinkering around that. For example, we have made sure the money that goes in is ring-fenced for investment, doesn't find its way into salaries and bonuses. They've also tightened up rules about company director behaviour. They can actually go to have criminal liability now if they frustrate investigations into it. So they're saying that we're trying to get tough on them to make sure poor behaviour, because incompetence at water companies is part of the issue. But the bigger issue is there's been underinvestment in this industry for many years. Some people say blame the regulator, and said particularly in the 2010s after the financial crisis, the regulator was at pains to try and keep bills low, but that came at to some extent at the expense of greater investment. You've got higher rainfall now, you've got higher population density and new housing projects. All of that is coming together and needs to be sorted out. This commission will report back in spring of next year.
Well, we'll keep with this throughout the programme. Simon Jack, our business editor, thank you.
20 to 7 is the time. The vaccine programme in the pandemic is credited with saving more than 100,000 lives, but it did harm some people too. And there's a call today for compensation to be improved. Kate Scott's husband, Jamie, suffered a serious brain injury after having the AstraZeneca vaccination. She says a government payout of £120,000 is not nearly enough to cover the costs of what's happened to her family.
Before his vaccine, he was super healthy, devoted father, loving husband, successful IT specialist. And like everyone, he went and got the vaccine when he was told to do so. 10 days after receiving the AstraZeneca vaccine, he became critically unwell. They took him to our local hospital, where he was quickly diagnosed with vaccine-induced thrombocytopenia and thrombosis. That's blood clots and a huge bleed. He was in a coma for 4 weeks and 5 days. And now is living at home with permanent brain damage, and our lives will never be the same again, or our two young children's lives. In my case, I became a carer for my husband, and at the time we had two very young children. That £120,000 would last about 1.7 years. Every day I feel this mix of gratitude, grief and guilt. I'm so grateful that Jamie is home, but I grieve the life that we planned. And then I feel guilty for struggling with our new reality.
That was Kate Scott talking to us. Let's talk to Fergus Walsh, the BBC's medical editor. And they're not the only family, Fergus, to find themselves in this position.
No, they're not. And, you know, we've spoken rightly a lot about the good that the COVID vaccines did. The AstraZeneca vaccine is credited with saving more than 6 million lives in its first year of use alone throughout the world. And the vaccine, COVID vaccine program, preventing over 120,000 deaths in its first year. But Freedom of Information request has shown that 188 people have received official payouts for vaccine damage, for COVID vaccines, and all but a handful of those are for the AstraZeneca vaccine. It had this very rare side effect, these blood clots, often in the brain, which could be fatal. And another 253 people have been told, yes, we accept that on the balance of probabilities, the AstraZeneca vaccine caused you damage, but you get nothing because you don't meet the threshold of 60% disability. And I've met several of these families. Mm. They feel they've been airbrushed out of the pandemic. They're not anti-vaxxers. They all went up, rolled up their sleeves and got vaccinated. And they feel now that they've been abandoned by the government and by AstraZeneca.
What would the scheme, how would the scheme work that they would regard as fair?
Well, so the vaccine damage payment scheme was set up in the 70s, and on average it's had two successful claims a year, but it's had this huge slew of claims to do with COVID vaccines. And the money, the £120,000 payout that you get for a successful claim, hasn't changed since 2007. So it hasn't gone up with inflation. If it had, it would now be nearly £200,000. But furthermore, many people have waited a year, even 2 years, to find out whether they'll get anything. So it's they would say it's giving too little to people. And then this 60% threshold. And Professor Adam Finn, who's a key member, or was a key member of the body which advised the government on the COVID vaccine rollout, he told the BBC that the vaccine damage payment scheme appeared arbitrary and needed overhaul. Otherwise, it risked undermining confidence in vaccines, because there is this social contract we have. We roll up our sleeves, we have jabs, and while everything in life has a risk, the benefits of vaccines greatly outweigh the potential side effects. But where there are these rare side effects, he says, you know, we should expect the state to support us and step in.
Okay, Fergus Walsh, our medical editor. Thank you.
7:16. There are some supporters politicians can do without. No, really. Downing Street was not amused when some of the prisoners released early yesterday praised the Prime Minister. As more than 1,000 people walked free, the Justice Secretary told MPs she'd had no choice in the face of overcrowded prisons in England and Wales. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Sean Corran.
For the second time in as many months, newspapers and television screens have shown offenders celebrating their early release outside prison gates. The Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, told MPs she'd had to let some prisoners leave once they'd served 40% of their sentence to ease overcrowding. But she said the last Conservative government was to blame and had left prisons on the point of collapse.
A situation that would have forced us to close the prison doors, cancel all trials, and force the police to halt their arrests. Crime would have gone unpunished, victims would never have seen justice done, and we would have witnessed the total breakdown of law and order.
Shabana Mahmood said the government would build more prisons, but smarter sentencing would help tackle the crisis. To that end, she'd asked the former Conservative Justice Secretary David Gawk to lead a review with a view to cutting reoffending and thinking about punishing people without sending them behind bars. The minister said in some ways, punishment outside prison could be more restrictive than jail. She said there would always be a place for prison, and she'd be encouraging the reviewers to look at other systems.
In Texas, for instance, Republican legislators were faced by a problem similar to ours: a soaring prison population, sky-high reoffending rates, and prisons that had run out of space. Working across political divides, the Texans introduced a system of good behaviour credits, where well-behaved prisoners could earn time off their sentence by engaging in rehabilitation programmes. And the results were remarkable. Crime fell by nearly a third, reaching the lowest levels in half a century.
The Conservative Shadow Justice Secretary, Edward Argar, said David Gawk had been his first boss as a minister, so he didn't want to prejudge the sentencing review.
It is important that we see the detail of this, and that whatever the outcome, it ensures that victims' voices are heard throughout, that the worst offenders, violent or sexual offenders, for example, stay behind bars for longer, that, as she alluded to, prolific offenders who cause so much blight and harm can still be subject to a custodial sentence where appropriate.
There were plenty of empty seats in the Commons chamber for this statement. In a week, it'll be standing room only when the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, delivers her first budget.
It is vital the criminal justice system is not subject to a flat budget or worse cuts in next week's budget, which would let down victims, those who work in the system, and the public. I fully appreciate she will not be able to prejudge that budget either at the dispatch box or in the media, but a fair financial settlement alongside her setting out her long-term plans for the system, and I acknowledge a little of which we've seen today, will be absolutely essential if victims and the public are to have confidence in her government on law and order.
The Liberal Democrats' justice spokesman, Josh Babarindi, was concerned about survivors of domestic abuse. He said they deserve to be safe.
Having grown up in a home of domestic violence myself at the hands of my mum's former partner, I share the concerns of the Victims Commissioner and survivors of domestic abuse that loopholes in the early release scheme's criteria could mean that some of their abusers who are convicted of violent offences but not of domestic violence-specific offences may have been released early today.
In her statement, the Justice Secretary said she would ask the reviewers to consider if some offenders should receive longer sentences. That went down well with the Conservative Sir Desmond Swain.
Can I congratulate her on recognising that for some prisoners, the shortcomings of short sentences are properly remedied by longer ones? Yeah. But on the review, David Gawk, it's difficult not to like him and even admire him. But I'm not alone in regarding him as a notorious wet, am I?
Well, I shall leave those characterisations to the internal workings of the Conservative Party.
And the Justice Secretary said she considered David Gawk to be a person with deep expertise in this area, who'd be able to hit the ground running.
Sean Curran there, and you can hear more on events in yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra and on Digital Radio.
Time now, 11 minutes to 7. The most effective treatment for Alzheimer's, a drug called donanemab, has been judged to be safe but is going to be banned on the NHS because of the cost. So says The Telegraph this morning, and it will not surprise anyone if that does happen, but it's still for many people a great disappointment. Of course, Professor Sir John Hardy's on the line, the chairman of molecular biology of neurological disease at the UCL Institute of Neurology, one of the world's leading researchers in this field and someone who has strong views on this subject. Good morning to you, Professor.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for coming on. And I doubt that you're surprised, but you think, do you, that this is a mistake?
Yes. I mean, I understand the reasons for it, but I do think it's a mistake. We need to improve our dementia services, and this approving this drug and the other similar drug, lecanemab, would have been an impetus to make those improvements.
What some campaigners say is that the argument about money is, in a sense, the wrong argument, because they're not taking into account, the authorities, the various savings that would be made by families not having to deal with dementia. Is that part of what you're saying, or is it a separate argument from the money?
It's part of what I'm saying, and it's certainly true that it's easier to judge the financial impact of people who, at working age, who then drop out of the workforce because of an illness, than it is to judge really the cost to families of having somebody with Alzheimer's disease. And those costs, as you indicated, are not properly assessed in the current system.
And of course, for wealthy people, they will be able to get the drug, presumably. They can just buy direct from the makers, who are Lilly, I think, in this case, aren't they?
Yes, that's right. And we're going to see all sorts of, you know, difficult issues to do with, for example, GoFundMe campaigns and so on. So it's going to lead to quite a lot of stirring about people trying to raise the money for treatment. It's not a satisfactory solution.
Professor Sir John Hardy, thank you.
The Times newspaper is reporting this morning that Britain's most senior police officer, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner Mark Rowley, has called for sweeping exemptions from prosecution for officers involved in shootings and other fatal incidents after Sergeant Martin Blake faced a murder trial and was cleared of the murder of Chris Cabba, an alleged gang member believed to have carried out a nightclub shooting 6 days before his death in September 2022. Ambimbola Johnson, a human rights barrister who was appointed last summer to a new scrutiny board set up by the National Police Chiefs Council to boost confidence among minority ethnic people, has been talking to me. And I started by asking what she made of the idea of making it harder to prosecute officers over such shootings.
I think that there is a risk of using this case
as some sort of paradigm or archetype, therefore base a legal system around. And there are a couple of things which I think are really important. It's already extremely rare for us to see police officers being prosecuted under the criminal justice system for action that they have conducted whilst in the line of duty. So the idea that because Martin Blake was brought to court for this matter, that we should therefore change the legal system is misleading, because it makes it seem as though this is par for the course, but it's actually not. It's already exceptionally rare to see that happen. This is a case where a man lost his life as a result of action by a police officer. And so we already have the fact that it was exceptional for him to come to court. And then we need to bear in mind that throughout the criminal process, there are checks and balances to ensure that cases that don't have merit are not left before the jury for them to come to their verdict. And this was a matter that went all the way through the trial process and it was allowed to remain before the jury until they drew their verdict, they reached their verdict. So I would be very hesitant to use this as the case to assert that there should be legal changes. And it's really important to ensure that the public can have faith in the police as a profession and also in the legal system.
And just to break in there, though, he could still lose his job because of procedure, and because he's been through the courts, he may still face dismissal. And I wonder, with what we know of the verdict, whether you think that is correct, because that's what that sets in train. And that's what perhaps Martin, we're in a situation where we're reading what one of the most senior police officers wants to change, what Mark Rowley wants to change. So do you understand that might be part of the reason why he's saying that?
This is not a typical case, and therefore using this as a reason to push for legislative change, it doesn't make sense, because this isn't normally what would happen throughout the process. But also, it's really interesting that what you have done in your question is to ask me about Chris Cabber's previous convictions as part of that consideration as to whether or not, for example, Martin Blake ought to lose his job. But Martin Blake, whether he would lose his job, whether he would have restrictions on his practice as a police officer and so on, that would come down to whether what he did was appropriate in the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And what's relevant in terms of the circumstances is that he did not know Chris Cabber's background at that time. Cabber's background doesn't come into the question when you're looking at questions around whether or not what Martin did was amounted to misconduct, gross misconduct and so on.
I was trying to explain why some police officers and members of the public, in fact, may then feel like that. And you're very right to point out that wasn't known and wasn't relevant at that point.
And also, it's really interesting, Emma, isn't it? Because I think that it's moments like this, actually, that really test our values as a society. It can be really easy to push for accountability, to push for certain things when you think that the person that you are advocating on behalf of is an angel. But actually, the test for us about how far we go with our values and our principles is around how we treat those people who maybe would otherwise be potentially devalued by society. So police accountability, whether or not you shoot somebody and so on, that shouldn't necessarily be dependent on the value judgments that we make against the person who's on the receiving end of that.
Do you agree, though, with the decision and the argument to release the information about his past? Because those restrictions having been lifted, we know the family didn't want them lifted. What do you make of how the police have handled that?
As I understand it, the application that the police made, one of the arguments that was put forward by the police for the reporting restrictions to be lifted was the idea that it could reduce the possibility of there being some civil unrest as a result of the acquittal. And I think that, I'm troubled by that being one of the reasons being put forward by the police when you look at the context that over the last 2 years, people have been working on behalf of Chris Cabber's family. So the family themselves, civil society organisations, members of public, and there hasn't been any violence or anything close to that when it has come to the gatherings which have been organised, when it's come to the eloquence, the grace, I think, that has been put forward by Chris Cabber's family and those who've spoken on behalf of them. So there isn't actually, in my in my observation, any evidence of there being civil unrest.
So one of those reasons you wouldn't agree with, but do you agree it was important for the public to have a fuller picture of the individual, not what was known at the time, but of Chris Cabot?
I can see that there are reasons to understand, you know, who was involved to provide that kind of, as you say, fuller picture, but it doesn't actually add to the context of Martin Blake's actions. And I think also, actually, there is a risk that the way that it's coming across is as though the police, with the kind of speed at which they have released this information, I think the optics of it are quite unhelpful. And it can actually look as though the police themselves are trying to lower Chris Cabot's value in the eyes of society. And I guess that's why I was saying earlier, it really does then tie in with this idea of how principled we are as a society. Do we only hold these values when we think that somebody comes to the conversation with completely clean hands? And I think that we really need to bear in mind that this is about a different test. It's not about Chris Cabot's personality. It's not about his
It's about what was known of
Martin Blake's actions, exactly, and what was known at the time.
Abimbola Johnson, a human rights barrister appointed to that new scrutiny board set up by the National Police Chiefs Council. It's 1 minute seven. Let's get the latest on the weather from Simon King.
Yeah, thanks, Emma. It's fog this morning across some central, eastern and through southern areas of England that we've got to be aware of. Some of that is going to be really quite dense this morning, something to be aware of. It's going to be slow to clear from parts of Lincolnshire and East Anglia, but eventually it will do. And for most parts, it's going to be a dry day with some sunny spells across England and Wales. I should also mention there are some fog patches elsewhere across Wales and northern England as well, particularly the Vale of York. But as I said, those clearing, sunny spells for most, one or two showers along the south coast, temperatures getting to about 12 to 17 degrees. Across Scotland and Northern Ireland, more cloud towards northern and western areas, a bit of rain in the far north and west of Scotland. There'll be some sunny spells, especially for Northern Ireland, southern and eastern Scotland, temperatures 12 to 14 degrees. But around the Murray Firth, we could see temperatures getting up to about 17 Celsius.
It's 7 o'clock, as you can hear. Thanks, Simon, for the weather there. It's Wednesday, the 23rd of October. Good to be with you and good to have your company. The headlines. Donald Trump's campaign team has accused the Labour Party of illegal foreign interference in the US presidential election. The biggest review of the water industry since it was privatised to consider all options, bar renationalisation, is on. And closer defence ties between Germany and the UK will see German surveillance planes using an RAF base in Scotland for some patrols. In the next half hour, we'll talk to the German ambassador about that and... What happens if a German manager wins the World Cup for England? Well, there'll be some celebrations, certainly, but we'll get the ambassador's point of view on that. And also coming up in the next half hour, that vaccine which could protect us against the very nasty vomiting bug, norovirus. The BBC News is read by Charles Carroll.
Donald Trump's presidential campaign has taken the extraordinary step of filing a legal complaint against the Labour Party, accusing it of blatantly interfering in the American election. The 6-page letter cites a now-deleted social media post in which Labour members were encouraged to travel to the US to campaign for the Democrats. In a statement, Mr. Trump's team claims the party has inspired what it calls Kamala Harris's dangerously liberal policies and rhetoric. But Sir Keir Starmer says Labour activists who've taken part were volunteering in their own time. Our North America editor Sarah Smith reports.
Labour Party members helping out Democrats in an election is nothing new. There have been exchanges between the two parties for decades. But in a letter to the Federal Election Watchdog, Donald Trump's team is complaining that volunteers from what it describes as the far-left Labour Party coming to America to campaign for Kamala Harris amounts to blatant election interference and that their help represents an illegal campaign contribution, citing a now-deleted social media post that offered to sort housing for campaign volunteers. Under US law, foreign nationals can campaign in American elections, but they cannot be paid for it. It's understood these trips are being funded by individuals themselves who've taken leave from their jobs, with accommodation being arranged by Democrat campaign volunteers, not paid for by the Labour Party. And there's no indication that the Harris campaign was aware of any organised Labour efforts. Both the Labour Party and the Harris campaign could be fined thousands of dollars if they're found to have broken the rules. And even if they haven't, this controversy will not make relations between Keir Starmer and Donald Trump any easier if he is re-elected as the US president.
An independent commission is to examine how to improve the troubled water industry. The review, described as the sector's biggest since privatisation in the late 1980s, has been set up by the UK and Welsh governments. It'll be led by Sir John Cunliffe, the former Deputy Governor of the Bank of England. Companies have faced fierce criticism over their crumbling infrastructure and pollution of waterways, while bills continue to rise. More details from our business editor, Simon Jack.
Government officials say all options are on the table for the new commission, including the reform or abolition of current regulators, including Ofwat. All options, that is, apart from nationalisation, which the government insists would cost taxpayers billions and take years. That means the money to fix the UK's crumbling infrastructure will ultimately have to come from higher customer bills. The government has already announced plans to get tough on water companies, including higher consumer compensation for problems and possible criminal liability for company directors if they don't cooperate with greater scrutiny.
Britain and Germany will today sign what the government here is calling a landmark defence agreement aimed at boosting security, investment and jobs. Under the plans, the German arms maker Rheinmetall will open a new factory in the UK to produce barrels for artillery guns, and German maritime surveillance aircraft will also fly patrols from RAF Lossiemouth in Scotland. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale reports.
This is part of a wider push by this government to strengthen relations with key European allies post-Brexit. The UK already has a defence pact with France, but this is the first with Germany. The Defence Secretary, John Healey, called it historic.
It brings our UK and German militaries closer together, our industries closer together, both to strengthen our security and Europe's security.
In reality, Germany and the UK already cooperate as NATO allies and in a joint venture, they're already making new armoured vehicles for the British Army. But the German defence giant Rheinmetall will also build a factory in the UK to manufacture barrels for artillery guns. It'll use British steel and support 400 jobs. There's a commitment to jointly develop new long-range missiles and drones and to bolster NATO's eastern flank.
A BBC investigation has found that Russia has expanded its recruitment of prisoners to fight in the war in Ukraine, including those merely accused of a crime. Work undertaken alongside the independent Russian website Mediazona to compare thousands of dog tags from Russian prison recruits with leaked records found a shift from the most serious offenders to those convicted of or still awaiting trial for much lower-level crimes. Olga Ivshina reports.
Some of the stories of the violent Russian criminals killed in Ukraine are notorious. Men who burned people alive or stabbed their own mother. But our investigation shows how Russia has expanded its recruitment to much lower category prisons, including those in pre-trial detention centers. Andrei Perlov is being held in one. He is an Olympic race walk gold medalist accused of fraud. This is his daughter, Alina.
My father refused to sign the contract. For him, it would be tantamount to admitting his guilt. He's not going to do that.
A new law introduced earlier this year obliges both prosecutors and defense lawyers to offer military contracts to almost anyone accused of a crime in Russia.
A vaccine which protects against the winter vomiting bug norovirus is to be tested by thousands of adults in the UK. If the trials are successful, experts say the vaccine could reduce the huge burden on the NHS caused by the effects of the easily spreadable virus. Here's our health reporter, Philippa Roxby.
Norovirus causes vomiting and diarrhoea. Every year in the UK, it's the cause of 80 deaths and 12,000 hospital admissions, and costs the NHS £100 million. The mRNA vaccine being trialled, made by Moderna in a collaboration between the UK government and the National Institute for Health and Care Research, targets three of the most common strains of norovirus. It will be tested on around 25,000 people, mostly over 60, in more than six countries around the world over the next 2 years. 27 NHS hospitals in England, Scotland and Wales will take part.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, says she's reached spending agreements with all government departments after ministers raised concerns about the scale of cuts expected to be outlined in next week's budget. Sources said there was significant angst across the government, with some ministers calling for a last-minute rethink. Speaking to the BBC, Ms. Reeves said she faced difficult decisions as she needed to find additional money. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
Several cabinet ministers wrote directly to the Prime Minister last week in alarm at the scale of cuts their departments could face at the budget. There are fears that as well as tax rises, there could be deep falls in funding for some areas to fill what government sources claim is a £40 billion gap in order to increase spending for other areas, like the NHS. Rachel Reeves said it was perfectly reasonable for cabinet ministers to argue their case, and settlements had now been reached with all government departments. But the Chancellor added there would be more challenges to come.
You can't just sort of pretend that the sort of fiscal position that we've inherited is all fine and there won't be any pain in fixing it. And I'm not going to pretend otherwise. I'm not going to say that all of those problems can just be magicked away.
Asked if she'd spoken to the former Labour Chancellor and Prime Minister Gordon Brown ahead of her first budget, Ms Reeves says she speaks to both him and Tony Blair regularly. And despite her fierce criticism of her Conservative predecessor over what she claimed was a £22 billion black hole in the public finances, Ms Reeves said she had a good relationship with Jeremy Hunt and the pair WhatsApp each other.
The RSPB has described the killing of protected birds of prey across the UK as a national disgrace. In a report, it blames rogue gamekeepers looking after their own stocks of birds. The British Association for Shooting and Conservation says its members have absolutely zero tolerance for illegal killings.
Thanks very much, Charles. It's 9 minutes past seven. Blatant foreign interference in the US presidential election. That's the charge Donald Trump is making against the UK Labour Party over its help to Kamala Harris's campaign. He's asking America's election watchdog to investigate. The claim centres around a now-deleted LinkedIn post from Labour's head of operations offering 10 spots for anyone willing in the party to travel to North Carolina to campaign for Harris and to sort their housing, implying, as Trump's campaign would have it, illegal contributions by foreign political volunteers. Sir Keir Starmer has played this all down and has said that Labour volunteers have helped in many such elections. Well, let's hear what Chris Ruddy has to say, a close friend of Donald Trump who supports him politically through the Newsmax TV network that he runs.
I think they like to point out that countries and other foreigners are certainly interested in influencing elections. Foreigners are not supporting Donald Trump, but supporting Kamala Harris. Certainly the Republican Party does not like the idea of foreign countries involving itself in U.S. elections. So perhaps that might be an issue. But look, I think President Trump has a good relationship with Keir Starmer. They had a very good meeting in New York, I understand. He has a very fond approach and view about Britain. His mother is from the United Kingdom, and so he has businesses in the United Kingdom. So I think that relationship is going to remain strong, even if there might be some political turbulence.
So what does it potentially say about the confidence in the Trump campaign to win if it's taking this sort of step at this close to the election?
There's a lot of things going on in the campaign, and there's probably a lot of activities going on, whether they're, I don't believe it's a focus. It has been mentioned in the American press. It's probably a much bigger story in Britain than it is here.
Yes.
And obviously people are focused on more important issues like Donald Trump's ability to get the French fries out through the drive-in window at McDonald's.
Big deal. Big deal.
And other important issues like that certainly made a lot of headlines, and people were talking about that a lot more than they were about the British members of the Labour Party that were coming over.
It's just, you know, Labour are in government, newly so in this country, and has just been accused by the man who might be the president or not in a couple of weeks' time of election interference. It's a big statement.
Well, let's say if the election is close, maybe it'll be a bigger issue. There were people that claimed in the 2020 election without much substantiation that there were foreign governments involved in the vote tabulations in the U.S. But it was mentioned by groups, and certain people supporting President Trump said that the votes were counted or ballots were reviewed without substantiation, I might add, in foreign countries. I heard Italy mentioned, I heard Spain mentioned, I heard Germany mentioned. So there's a lot of things that go on and there's a lot of talk. And I guess it's more fodder for people that are very concerned about foreign involvement here in the U.S.
But I suppose, is that what you think, you know, your friend Donald Trump thinks?
Well, I think Donald Trump would not like the idea that a foreign country was sending over campaign workers.
Even though we know there's been a precedent of that in the past, you know, just looking also much further back, for instance, in 1992, two of those from John Major's campaign on the conservative side flew out to Washington to help advise George H.W. Bush to attack Bill Clinton's character. You know, there are these examples.
It may have happened in the past, and people are somewhat forgetful of the past, and they focus on things that are happening now. That, for example, I believe there were Trump campaign officials or people close to the Trump campaign today that went down to Brazil to help President Bolsonaro win re-election there. But I think they were doing it more as an ad hoc activity without formally the Republican Party, per se, sending them down there.
It's the organized nature of this, potentially, as the issue, because it is a serious accusation. Also, the Labour have made, as is asserted, illegal contributions to the Democrats. I don't know if you are aware of what evidence there is for that accusation.
Well, I think there's a twofold problem. One is that the Labour Party is officially supporting the idea of sending volunteers over to work on a partisan Democratic campaign. And then second, the Labour Party is one and the same with the governing party of Britain and the government there. So there's a perception that perhaps the government may be interfering. As I said, it may be more of a perception problem than a legal one. But obviously, if you send campaign workers and somebody's paying them food or housing or supporting their ability, that's considered a campaign expenditure. That would be considered potentially a campaign donation. I'm not an election lawyer.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
And that brings us to 7:15. A pact between Germany and the United Kingdom, a landmark agreement to be signed in London today by Germany's defence minister. It will lead, we are told, to cooperation, but does it really address the urgent defence needs that both Germany and Britain have, and indeed the wider European continent? Let's talk to Miguel Berger, who is Germany's ambassador to the UK and is here in the studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Tell us what is planned, first of all. What will it actually mean?
Yeah, the defense agreement will mean that we will cooperate along a broad range of issues. It will mean that we will jointly build up our industrial capacities, artillery, gun barrel production in the US, in the UK. We already have a lot which is ongoing. If you think about Airbus, if you think about the armored vehicle Boxer, but we want to expand that. Also very important, I think, that we will have German airplanes, P-8, who will be based in Scotland to help identify possible Russian submarines. We will work jointly on deep strike precision weapons, which will be a conventional reaction to Russia's build-up of short-range nuclear missiles. So very important steps of collaboration, which are the result of the geopolitical challenges we are facing.
Yeah, and one of those challenges, of course, is the potential that Donald Trump becomes president again in the United States. Are we anywhere close, Germany, Britain, but the wider European continent, to being Trump-proofed, as it were?
No, I think that would go too far. What we have to do, whoever governs in the US, is that we strengthen the European pillar of NATO, and that is what we are doing. So Germany invested $100 billion in building up again the armed forces. We are cooperating. As I said, we are building up industrial capacities, because in the end, whoever governs in the US, the expectation is that we in Europe do more. And that is what we are trying to do with this defense agreement and with other.
And politically, with this defense agreement, does Britain get anything out of it in terms of its wider relationship with the EU? Because it's often said, isn't it, that Britain needs all sorts of things from the EU, would like to have a more cooperative relationship. And one of the things we can offer, in a sense, now is our military prowess, etc. Do you think it might have any bearing, not just in Germany with the German government, but more widely?
Yes, I would see this really as a big element, a big part of this reset. So in my view, the reset is in full swing. We are working on a bilateral treaty between Germany and the United Kingdom. Military defense security will be one element of it, and this will be signed today. But then we will also have very soon, I think, negotiations on the security pact the British government has proposed. And I think it's very important for your listeners to understand that the European Commission in the next 5 years will have a very strong focus on defense. Joint procurement, a European defense initiative, for the first time a European commissioner on defense. And obviously the question is, what can the role of the British defense industry, of the capacities of the United Kingdom be in this joint endeavor? And that is what we are working on.
And meanwhile, via Thomas Tuchel, Germany is helping England win the next World Cup.
Yes, I'm very worried about the next penalty shootout, to be honest. Well, but I must say it's a very bold move. And for Tuchel, I think the objective is very clear, or you become a world champion or you are out.
No pressure.
No pressure at all.
You got it.
Yes.
Miguel Berger, Germany's ambassador to the UK. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's 18 minutes past seven. The Prime Minister is travelling to Samoa for the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, as you've been hearing in the news. Despite not being on the formal agenda, it's being reported that 14 Caribbean nations will seek to raise the issue of Britain paying reparations to compensate for historic slavery. Downing Street has ruled out an official apology or compensation. Belle Ribeiro-Addy, Labour MP for Clapham and Brixton Hill. She chairs the All-Party Parliamentary Group for African Reparations, joins us on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Downing Street has consistently said reparations not on the agenda and no official apology, no compensation. What do you say to that?
Well, that has to be wrong. We are meant to be a Commonwealth family of nations, and I didn't realise that the UK was still in a position to, you know, unilaterally just tell people that we're not going to discuss a particular issue. 14 countries is no small feat, and the idea that the UK still has that kind of veto reeks of the colonialism that people are, you know, still seeking some sort of resolution to. I don't believe that we should be in that position, and I think it's extremely disrespectful to those countries. We don't see them as equals if we can tell them what they want to be discussed shouldn't be discussed.
We'll have to see how it plays out, of course. But David Lammy is now the Foreign Secretary, and it's worth reminding us all, in 2018 he wrote on Twitter in opposition, "As Caribbean people enslaved, colonised and invited to Britain as citizens, we remember our history. We don't just want an apology, we want reparations and compensation." You know, he's going to be at this meeting, and he's obviously the Foreign Secretary, as I say now. How do you think he is squaring that circle?
Well, David Lammy is the Foreign Secretary, and obviously he's bound by collective responsibility. I don't believe he's someone who says things that he doesn't necessarily mean, but it will be a very difficult one for him because of what 10 Downing Street are saying. But one thing I must point out is that, you know, that hasn't necessarily come from a minister. We also have to look at the fact that King Charles, you know, in a meeting not so long ago, was saying that he was willing to discuss it, or he thought that it was important that it was discussed. However, we still can't seem to be able to go beyond the line of sorrow and deep regret, which are not fitting sentiments for one of the worst crimes in humanity. I mean, there are many different ways to go about compensation and reparations. Reparations is not just about, you know, finances, but an apology is absolutely free.
Yes, you're right to say, to remind people of what the King said, but stop short of an apology. That would have depended on the agreement of ministers. Looking back, I know it's not your government, but Rishi Sunak, answering a question from you last year on this issue, talked about, if I was just to summarise it slightly, was to focus on the here and now. Trying to unpick our history is not the right way forward and not something we're going to focus our energies on. How disappointed are you that your government, your leader of the Labour Party, has continued with that line?
I mean, I find it difficult, particularly what Rishi Sunak said about focusing on the here and now, because we're never going to be able to do that. All the nations that are most impacted are never going to be able to do that unless they are given a fighting chance. They continue to suffer the economic impact of enslavement and colonialism, and we have a responsibility for that, whether or not we were directly involved. We also have to remember that in you know, the UK government took out its largest loan ever had to pay off the slave owners, not the enslaved. And we only finished paying that off in 2015, which means that people like myself, the Windrush generation, yourselves, we all contributed to paying slave owners, people whose families remain some of the richest in society. I worry about the government not looking at the issue now, because, you know, if we're not careful, the Commonwealth will crumble. The UK has recently left its largest trading partner, you know, Europe. Through Brexit, we've left. We are going around the world looking for new trade deals. We are essentially going around the world looking for friends. Who is the best group of countries we could do that with? One with which we have a shared history, the Commonwealth. So for those who don't believe in the very important moral argument, I would make the economic one to them. Countries like India and South Africa, two of the largest growing economies in the world, have decided not to go to the Commonwealth. They've gone to BRICS instead.
A lot more to talk about. I hope we can do it again. Belle Ribeiro, Addy, Labour MP for Clapham and Brixton Hill, and the chair of that all-party parliamentary group for African reparations. Thank you.
23 minutes past seven. The International Monetary Fund says the UK is going to grow faster than expected this year. Sean is back with that.
Yep. The IMF, which is an organisation with 190 countries as members that tracks and advises those countries, expects the UK to grow by 1.1% this year, up from the 0.7% it was thinking just a few months ago. Ben Nabarro is the chief UK economist at the investment bank Citi. Morning, Ben. What's driving the more optimistic outlook?
Good morning. Indeed. So the IMF upgraded its GDP forecast for the UK this year, up from 0.7 previously to 1.1 now. What we're beginning to see in the UK economy at present is, after a sequence of extraordinary supply shocks over recent years, be it the energy shock following the outbreak of the conflict in Ukraine, obviously COVID before that, we're now beginning to see the economic consequences of those shocks fade, and in turn, some underlying capacity growth return to the UK economy. So we've seen that in terms of the overshoots already year to date, where UK growth, particularly through the first half of this year, surprised to the upside. And what the IMF are doing here is really, you know, sort of marking to market, given those upside surprises. And as I say, the sort of underlying picture is beginning to improve as those supply shocks are fading. And fundamentally, that is thankfully very good news.
So good news at the moment. We've got a budget next week. Do you expect that budget to reinforce that optimism, or could it halt it?
It's a good question. I think in terms of the sort of overall growth consequences of what we're likely to see next week, I mean, what will really matter macroeconomically is not necessarily how much is raised in tax per se, but the overall balance of tax and spend. And overall, I think our expectations would be that the overall balance of that package is unlikely to be particularly, you know, either growth enhancing or destructive, but pretty well balanced. It's more, you know, seeing increases on both sides of the equation. I would say that in terms of the challenges the Chancellor faces at present, the UK's current sort of balance between particularly monetary policy and fiscal policy is very uneven. We've got very, very tight monetary policy still at present, even if the Bank of England has started cutting, and fiscal policy has been very accommodative for some time.
So, just on that, Ben, so you've got the fiscal policy, the government decisions, and the monetary policy, the Bank of England decisions. Bank of England base rate at 5% right now. Are they moving at the right pace in cutting rates, just briefly?
I don't. We would err towards thinking they probably need to move a bit faster. We saw Andrew Bailey reference the possibility of moving a bit more decisively in an interview with The Guardian earlier this month. We'll be looking very closely to see whether that message is reaffirmed this week. But our sense is, look, I think the recent news on UK inflation has been very good, consistent with those supply improvements.
Right.
The UK overall is roughly at capacity, so supply and demand in the economy are roughly in balance.
Okay.
The implication is you should be trying to get back to neutral really quite quickly. And so in that sense, you should be cutting pretty sharply to get back onto a more even keel.
Ben, thank you. Ben Nabarro from the investment bank Citi.
Sean, thanks so much for that. Let's turn our attention now to a vaccine which protects against the winter vomiting bug norovirus, which is set for large-scale trials in thousands of adults across the UK. And if they are successful, experts say the vaccine could reduce the huge burden on the NHS caused by the effects of that easily spreadable and just awful virus every year. Professor Saul Faust is the co-clinical lead for the National Institute for Health and Care Research Vaccine and Innovation Pathway. Good morning.
Good morning.
I say it's awful, having had it a few times, actually. It is a serious condition, though, for many as well.
I think that's right, particularly for people in care homes or other institutions and schools. But the elderly and frail are often very badly affected by the winter vomiting virus, and often if admitted to hospital, really become quite ill, and sometimes don't recover their level of previous function, you know, even once they get better and are discharged. So, you know, we have about 12,000 hospitalizations a year with the vomiting virus, norovirus, and it would be really good both for people who suffer from the condition, the care homes, the people who work for them, and of course the UK economy and getting the NHS back on its feet if we were to be able to find a vaccine to prevent it.
And how confident can you be at this stage? I mentioned it's a large trial.
Yeah, this is the phase three trial that we're opening in the United Kingdom this week at 37 sites, 27 across the NHS. You can never be completely confident that a vaccine's going to work until you've done your phase three trial, just like people remember from 2020 and then the results from the COVID trials that we heard about in November, December 2020. So this is a trial of 25,000 people globally. We hope 10% of that number will come from the UK between now and the end of December. That's about 2,500 people. And we are looking for some younger people to take part in the trial who are in at-risk groups, so healthcare workers, childcare providers, and so on, people who work in care homes. But the majority of people who take part will be over 60 and even older, right up through the ages in order to find a vaccine that protects the people most at risk.
Yeah, is that the goal, to give it to those who are most at risk, or is this one of the ones that will be added into that list that people think of when the winter comes?
This is you know, how the UK deploy a vaccine is a JCVI decision, yes. And the NHS decision at the time once we find a vaccine that works. But the aim of this trial and this part of the work is to find a vaccine that protects those most at risk, and how that will be given and exactly what time of year will be determined in the future.
Well, good luck, I suppose.
Thank you very much indeed.
Good point to say that as you keep going on this stage. Professor Saul Faust, thank you.
The time, 7:30. Mike Williams with the sport.
Justin, thank you. Quite the night for Aston Villa in the Champions League.
It's floated into the near post.
He's always done it.
Has got his Champions League goal, and Aston Villa are cruising to three wins out of three in the Champions League.
Yes, a third straight victory in this season's competition last night sees Aston Villa top the table this morning. They beat the Italian side Bologna 2-0 at Villa Park. Victory 2 for Arsenal. They beat Shakhtar Donetsk 1-0 at the Emirates. Tonight, Celtic are away to Atalanta. That's an early kickoff at 5:45. Then at 8 p.m, Manchester City host Sparta Prague. Whilst on 5 Live and BBC Sounds, you can hear RB Leipzig against Liverpool. Elsewhere, today is a big day for rugby league in the UK. The governing body is set to announce which teams will compete in which leagues from next year on the basis of a new grading system for all professional clubs. It's part of rugby league's commercial relationship with the sports media giant IMG. Well, the BBC's rugby league reporter Matt Newsome joins us now to explain more. Morning, Matt.
Good morning.
So for those not following this story as closely as perhaps some others have been, just explain a bit of background here. How have we got to this point today?
Well, the traditional promotion relegation system, which you see in many leagues, it has now been replaced by this new grading system, and it works on a kind of franchising basis. And the kind of crux of it is that Super League's revenues have decreased, the TV deal was lower. And so this new policy of trying to grade teams by criteria away from the pitch is in a sense a way of saying, look, you've got to be sustainable for yourself, but also take responsibility for your own businesses as well.
So it's all being announced today, isn't it, later this morning. What are we expected to be the big headlines?
Well, the big winners are Wakefield, who were relegated last season in the kind of organic up and down, one up, one down system. And London, who replaced them, who were, you know, almost behind the eight ball from the start, have also been relegated. So That's the kind of very basic figures. I think Castleford are another team that would class themselves as winners as well. They've risen to an A grade, and they're going to be kind of guaranteed their Super League place too. But yeah, Wakefield, a team who were in the Championship and performed very well, would have been promoted as it was anyway in the old system. But under this new guys, they've got a new stand, that kind of thing, and they have certainly taken this IMG model by the horns, so to speak.
Yeah, a bit of an irony, isn't it? This is what would have actually happened, but by virtue of league placings anyway. So this is the new era, Matt, as we say. What next? What would you say is the blueprint for Super League clubs to be successful going forward?
Well, I think Hull, Kingston Rovers, who were this season's grand finalists in the Super League, are possibly, you know, the kind of poster boys for this. Really, they appointed a board, a multi-skilled board, with the same kind of scrutiny and in-depth work that you would assemble a squad. They in the coach, they signed a shrewd coach. He in turn has prompted shrewd recruitment. The better performances have resulted in better recruitment, and I guess now that the idea is that under this new system is that ambition doesn't die. The notion now is that, though, you don't just spend money on your salary cap, you don't just max out on marquee players, you look to be sustainable across the board.
Well, a big morning awaits for the sport of rugby league, and Matt Newsome will be reporting on it for the BBC Sport website later on this morning. Got to leave it there, though. Matt Newsome, many thanks.
Mike, thank you for that. Radio 4 venturing into the moral maze, of course, this evening. Our guide, Michael Burke. Good morning, Michael.
Morning, Emma. Morning, Justin. Tonight's moral maze is an issue in which I have a personal stake. 40 years ago today, my report on the famine in Ethiopia ran first across the BBC, then on most major television stations worldwide. The response was unprecedented, the biggest rescue operation in history, they said, set to music and driven by a sense of engagement between the First and Third Worlds never seen before or since. 40 years on, what's our responsibility to the global poor? In a very different world that's seen aid fail to cure or often even alleviate Africa's ills, and sensitive to accusations of white saviourism these days, how should that responsibility best be discharged? The Moral Maze after the news at 8 tonight.
Michael, thank you. To the weather, areas of mist and fog will clear this morning. It's then going to be dry, fine, sunny even for most of us.
And you're listening to Today. We hope to keep it sunny for you on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. It's 26 minutes to 8. Let's get a summary of the news from Charles Carroll.
Donald Trump's campaign team has accused the Labour Party here of interfering in the US presidential election, following reports that some party activists have been campaigning for Kamala Harris. Sir Keir Starmer said members volunteering for the US Democrats were doing so in their spare time and were not receiving party funding. An independent commission is to examine how to improve the troubled water industry. The review, described as the sector's biggest since privatisation in the late 1980s, has been set up by the UK and Welsh governments. It will be led by Sir John Cunliffe, the former Deputy Governor of the Bank of England. Companies have faced fierce criticism over their crumbling infrastructure and pollution of waterways while bills continue to rise. Britain and Germany will today sign what the government's calling a landmark defence agreement aimed at boosting security, investment and jobs. Under the plans, the German arms maker Rheinmetall will open a new factory in the UK to manufacture barrels for artillery guns, supporting 400 jobs. The agreement is part of a wider push by the government to reset relations with key European allies post-Brexit. A BBC investigation has found that Russia has expanded its recruitment of prisoners to fight in Ukraine. Those under pressure to sign up for the war now include people in pre-trial detention, accused of minor offences, not just those convicted of brutal crimes. A vaccine is to be trialled on thousands of people in more than six countries to find out if it could protect against norovirus, a stomach bug that causes vomiting and diarrhoea. If successful, researchers say it would reduce the number of vulnerable adults in hospital during the winter. And Radiohead's Tom York, the actress Julianne Moore, and the Nobel Prize-winning author Sir Kazuo Ishiguro have joined forces with other musicians, actors and writers to protest about the use of artificial intelligence in the arts. In an open letter, the group warns of a major unjust threat to artists' livelihoods by the unlicensed use of creative works to train generative AI. They insist it must not be permitted.
Thank you. 24 minutes to 8 is the time. A row between Labour and the Trump campaign is the latest tricky diplomatic issue that Keir Starmer faces as he tries to navigate an election stateside that could see the former president re-elected. Chris Mason, our political editor, is making the long journey with the Prime Minister to Samoa for the Commonwealth Summit. During a fueling stop in Canada, he told me about the row and the Prime Minister's thoughts.
Well, they are trying to say, Justin, that it is entirely normal, which it is often, for people who are sort of put themselves under the Labour Party flag, either as employees or as activists who would go out to America during US presidential races and campaign for the Democrats. I think what has given this a bit of spike is that this Labour Party head of operations, Sophia Patel, this posting that she made on LinkedIn, the CV and jobs website, wasn't perhaps with hindsight as judiciously written as it might have been, in that it talked about having 10 spots available for anyone willing to travel to North Carolina to campaign for the Harris campaign. We will sort your housing, it said. And that has allowed the Trump campaign, in this complaint to the Federal Electoral Commission or Election Commission, to say, well, hang on a minute, does this not amount to overstepping the mark in terms of interference. So Keir Starmer saying to us in the little huddle that he did with reporters on this first leg of this massive schlep to the South Pacific that, you know, it doesn't really add up to very much. But here is the guy saying that, who just a fortnight ago was going to see Donald Trump at Trump Tower to meet him for the first time to try and build that relationship in case in a couple of weeks' time he's looking at the prospect of a second Trump term in the new year.
Yeah, and if they weren't sensitive about it, the LinkedIn posting presumably would still be there, and it isn't.
Well, indeed. Exactly that. I mean, I think there's an acknowledgement privately that the wording of it was a little perhaps injudicious, because that allows people to conclude when you read those words that it might have involved somehow some sort of money exchange. As I say, Labour Party making the point that people who are going out there are doing so in their own time, and that the Labour Party isn't paying for it, and that it's people sort of, you know, dossing on people's sofas, etc., effectively during their holiday time. But yeah, as ever with these things, when people find themselves in trouble courtesy of their social media activity, the key fact so often is the post still there? Answer in this case, no.
That was Chris Mason. Steve Reid is the Environment Secretary. He's been talking to me on the day that a review of the dysfunctional water industry is announced, and we will get to that. First, though, I asked him whether Labour campaigners are being paid for by anyone other than themselves to campaign for the Democrats.
Absolutely not. It's up to private individuals what they do with their free time, and it's actually perfectly normal for people who are interested in politics to go from one country to campaign for a sister party in another country. I've seen Americans in the UK doing that in our elections, but none of this has been organised or paid for by the Labour Party. This is just individuals using their own time and their own money.
So when this LinkedIn post said housing would be sorted, what did it mean?
Well, you'll have to speak to the person who made the LinkedIn post, but the Labour Party has nothing to do with organising this.
Right, and the post itself has been taken down, which is a sign, presumably, that it was wrongly worded, if nothing more.
Yeah, I can't say that I saw it.
Mm. Do you want Donald Trump to win or to lose?
Whoever the American people elect as their president, the United Kingdom government will work with them very closely. We've had a special relationship with the US for many decades now, and that will continue into the future. Keir Starmer, as our Prime Minister, has had meetings with President Joe Biden. He's also met recently with Donald Trump, and they had a very civilised and respectful conversation. And I expect whoever wins, whether it's Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, our Prime Minister will have a close working relationship with them.
And people will understand that, but a lot of Labour Party supporters will say this is a kind of crazy row to have. Obviously, we don't want Donald Trump to win. We think he is uniquely dangerous to the world, and we need to do anything we can to stop him. And we ought to be able to say that pretty openly.
Well, individuals will have their own view. It's important.
But the Labour Party?
We're talking about the government of the United Kingdom.
No, I'm just talking about the Labour Party, though, which still exists as an entity, doesn't it?
Whoever is leading the government of the United States. And it's very important that whoever Americans elect, we respect the outcome of their democracy. And the UK and the US, whoever is leading both of those countries, will and must continue to have the strong, solid, special relationship that's done us both such good service over the past decades.
Let us turn to the water industry here and to specifically Ofwat, the regulator. There is a warm welcome, it's fair to say, for the government having a review of the water industry and an understanding right across the board that it doesn't work as it's currently set up. But some people are saying, hang on a second, we know that the regulator is not doing its job. Why not say right at the start we're going to reorganise it or get rid of it?
Well, what I've done, I've asked Sir John Cunliffe, the former Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, to lead a thoroughgoing root and branch review as part of the commission that he will be leading. The things that the public are angry about are the record levels of sewage pollution that is filthying our rivers, lakes and seas. The lack of water infrastructure is holding back the development of housing that we desperately need in this country to give people places to live, but also to grow the economy. And as things stand, by the mid-2030s, we start to have a shortage of drinking water. Now, the water sector is failing, and these are the things, these are the symptoms of that problem.
Because it's been badly regulated, that's what people say. So we know that it hasn't been properly regulated is the charge, and so go for the regulator now to get that in place, or at least start to get that in place right at the beginning. You don't need to have a review to discover that.
There are certainly very severe failures of regulation and governance that underpin the problems that we're seeing in the water sector. And what I've asked Sir John to do is look from the bottom up at the whole sector. Now, that will include regulation and the regulator, but I'm not going to predict what he might come up with, because that is for him and the panel of experts that he'll be working for, that will be covering views including environmental campaigners, customers, investors, the health sector as well. We want to hear all of those views to come up with a model that will work for the future. We need a water sector that is investable and that can build the infrastructure that we need to clean up our water and allow development to go ahead.
And to keep it investable, does that not mean that in the future, when the kinds of sums of money are spent on it that need to be spent, it will be the customers who will have to pay?
One of the things I want to prevent happening ever again is the size of bill increases that Ofwat has been talking about during the current review period. The reason they are proposing those is because the previous Conservative government for 14 years failed to bring in the necessary level of investment, and so our water infrastructure crumbled to the point that it became far more expensive to fix it, and it is customers that are being therefore made to pay twice because of the failure of the Conservative government. I'm drawing a line in the sand here. I can't undo the damage the Conservatives did. I can make sure it never happens again into the future.
Steve Reid, Environment Secretary, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Turning our attention, well, we'll come back to that a bit later in the programme, but turning our attention now to something else completely different, because our next guest said he nearly fell off of his chair when he realised what he was seeing. I'm talking about a discovery being announced by the Bodleian Libraries that some doodles on the back of copper plates 250 years ago are believed to be the handiwork of the poet, painter and printmaker William Blake. Mark Crosby, romanticist, fellow of the Society of Antiquaries, associate professor of literature at Kansas State University, whose research led to that discovery, is here. Mark, I think I should start by saying congratulations, perhaps.
Oh, thank you very much, Emma.
tell us how this came about.
I've been researching Blake's apprenticeship material since about 2008, and I noticed that there were incised markings on the back of the copper plates. Most of these markings are barely visible to the human eye. Fortunately, the Bodleian has been trialling a new system of photography, which it's called photometric stereo. And basically what it does is it captures the microtopography of a copper plate. Using this system, we could see these incised markings on the versos of the plates and on the rectos of the plates, so there's the fronts of the plates. There are etchings after Blake's drawings. Now, one of the fascinating aspects of these incised markings are they show an engraver practicing the linear techniques necessary to become successful in their profession. On the other hand, the motifs show an apprentice engraver creating agency or producing agency beyond the strict limits of his professional training. Now, in 1801, Blake refers to engraving as drawing on copper. And we get the sense that with these doodles, Blake is doing exactly that, displaying his own distinctive style in terms of a arrow and a miniature face. This is, in many respects, one of Blake's earliest creative endeavours.
It's incredible to think of technology allowing us to see things that, you know, if it is his handiwork, as is believed, that no one was meant to see.
That's right. Certainly the face is, personal, private art, intimate art created by an apprentice during a long day of hard work. He would flip over the copper plate and doodle. And, you know, this technology has allowed us to see, for the first time since they were made 250 years ago, this art. The other thing to say about this art, when you're doing a doodle, both the conception of the art and the execution are collapsed into one artistic gesture. And we get that here with these newly discovered pieces of art.
Well, thank you for talking to us about it and bringing it to all of our attention there. Mark Crosby with some doodles believed to be William Blake's. Coming up on this programme, stay with us before 8 a.m. We'll be returning to the Chris Cabber verdict. I'll be speaking live to Neil Bazzu, until recently one of the country's most senior police officers, about that idea of armed police being shielded from trials. All that to come.
12 minutes to 8 is the time now, though, and we have thought for the day. The speaker this morning, Nick Baines, the Anglican Bishop of Leeds. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, I've heard a faint rumour that a budget might be coming our way soon. Speculation is rife about what Rachel Reeves might include, exclude, put in the pending tray and so on. But until we actually hear and read it, we don't quite know what to expect, despite the deluge of advice the Chancellor is getting at every turn. What we can say is that a budget is not simply a game with numbers. Decisions about income and expenditure have a powerful, not always obvious, impact on everyone's life. So it matters what money goes where. Now, someone once called a budget theology by numbers. What this means is that where the money gets allocated will tell us something about who we think we are. Politicians, as well as preachers, are rightly judged not by the bold statements they make or the rhetoric they craft, but rather by the way they dispose of stuff, money, material things, social structures. So it's right that the Chancellor's choices are going to be controversial, and it has always been thus. Now, I go back 3,000 years to when a group of people were about to establish a new society in a new land. And rather than being given a send-off party, God gave them some hard instructions. When you get there, you will put down your roots, cultivate the lands, build your homes and economy, and when you have plenty, you will forget that once you had nothing and were dependent on others. So when you gather in your harvest, the first thing you will do is take 10% to the priest and recite a creed. The creed reminds you that my fathers had nothing and knew what it was to depend on and receive from others. Never forget this, because if you do, you will start treating other people as your slaves, as a problem. Now, the other rule was that another 10% had to be left around the edges of the field so that poor, marginalised, homeless people could always find something to eat. Now, this isn't some romantic notion of egalitarian generosity. No, it's rather an expression of the mutual obligation demanded by a society that claims to be, or at least wants to be, just. How we allocate our resources, in our case, paying taxes, engaging in democratic and respectful debate, looking for how the weakest are faring, tells us the truth about who we think we are and what we think matters. Of course, harvesting crops once, twice a year is not the same as trying to set out a 5 or 10 year plan, but the principle of mutuality still holds power.
And that was Thought for the Day with Nick Baines, the Anglican Bishop of Leeds. It brings us to 10 to 8.
Should it be made more difficult to prosecute police firearms officers involved in shootings? The country's most senior police officer, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Sir Mark Rowley, has called the system holding police to account broken after Sergeant Martin Blake was cleared of the murder of Chris Cabber, an alleged gang member believed to have carried out a nightclub shooting 6 days before his death.
Now the Times newspaper reports that Sir Mark is pushing for sweeping exemptions for officers involved in shootings. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, will make a statement to MPs about the case. Well, yesterday here on the programme, a former firearms officer who arrived at the scene as Chris Cabot was shot told us that the case never should have gone to court.
I believe that at no point was there any evidence that Martin Blake had done anything wrong or at least deviated from his training or indeed the law. He was on Kirkstall Gardens that night on behalf of the state. The state put Martin Blake there that night and the state trained him to do the fearsome thing that he had to do.
Listening to that, Neil Bazzi, former Assistant Commissioner in the Metropolitan Police, former head of counter-terrorism policing and in charge of armed police response in 2014. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma. Thanks for inviting me on.
Well, it's important to get your take on this as we hear that Sir Mark Rowley, certainly in the Times, is pushing for exemptions for officers involved in shootings. What do you make of that?
Well, I think what I make of the entire case is that this is just tragedy upon tragedy. I mean, clearly the Chris Cabot family didn't want to find themselves in the horrific position they're in, frustrated and grieving. Neither did Martin Blake and armed policing want to find himself in the position he was in. So there are multiple tragedies here. There's clearly a lack of confidence both from, and we need to be careful how we use the expression, the black community. There are many communities, many individuals, but there is clearly a crisis of confidence in the criminal justice system and in policing. And policing knows that and is going to have to do a lot to build that trust back. But there is a crisis of confidence amongst armed policing as well about how they are supported to do probably the most difficult job in policing, where they have split seconds to make decisions that are pored over for years afterwards. And that kind of hindsight is what Sir Mark, I think, is talking about. And it's important to read the full text of the Times story to understand what he's talking about. He's not talking about an exemption from prosecuting police officers. He's talking about the system that goes into police police incident investigation. And Sir Mark and I have been here before. He was my boss when I was head of armed policing, when we were preparing for the Mark Duggan inquest and after the Azelle Rodney trial. And we had to completely relook at the way officers were investigated following a police shooting because it was not deemed to be fair to the officers at that time.
So
and I've looked at some of the measures he is talking about and some of them are absolutely correct.
It's important to make that distinction, but broadly, I suppose what people are hearing is there needs to be more protection for those police officers in that moment, especially those, as we were just hearing, didn't deviate from training. And are you supporting that?
I've read exactly what he's reported as having said in the Times, and clearly he's been to the Home Secretary to discuss this if she's going to be making a statement. And the idea that the process needs to be sped up is absolutely true. This is devastating for bereaved families. It's devastating for armed officers. They have the coroner's inquest and potentially gross misconduct.
So sped up, but exemptions.
A second bite of the cherry for effectively the same offence, but with a lower standard of proof. And, you know, that is going to be months of more agony for both sides of this argument. Those things need to be sped up. And the investigations need to be competent, thorough, accountable,
of course,
swift.
But should a case like this come to court again? Should a police officer be put through that?
Well, the reality is if a police officer acts unlawfully, then just like any other member of the public, unlawful act, yes.
But if they haven't deviated,
deviated from training, where they have been asked to do their job, the hardest job in policing, to potentially put their life on offer or to take a life.
Yes.
And they are adhering to their training. No, they shouldn't be prosecuted. That's not an unlawful act. There's much more complexity to it than that. And clearly lawyers have to look at the evidence. But I was surprised that the IOPC made such a quick decision to announce it as a murder inquiry. I would want, as a former police officer, to know why that decision was made so swiftly. And I was surprised by the charging decision. Now, clearly, there is a lack of faith in that decision. And Sir Mark is also calling for prosecutors to make clear their decision-making process against their two co-tests.
Yes,
I know those prosecutors well. They're normally very good. So I'm not second-guessing what they've done, but somebody probably needs to independently review that decision.
We should make clear, with reporting restrictions lifted a lot more than was, of course, learned about Chris Cabot. That wasn't known to the police officer in question at the time. The family had requested for those that information about his criminal past not to be made public until the court case. It was a temporary request until the court case the inquest, concluded. But just to say, you know, front page of the Telegraph this morning, you know, that same police officer, Sergeant Martin Blake, could still lose his job. He could still face a sack for gross misconduct because of the IOPC, Independent Office for Police Conduct, looking into him. I mean,
that's correct.
What do you make of that, for people who find that difficult? Weeks. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, that process could take many weeks, if not months. We'll come after the resumed coronial inquest, which again may take months to set up. Both the family, Chris Cabber's family and Martin Blake and his family, will have to go through that uncertainty, as will armed policing. We've seen when the decision was made to charge the reaction of armed police officers, some no longer wanting to carry weapons. There is a very fine balance here about this criminal justice system to try and find some faith and confidence in the system on both sides. But having a second process at a lower standard of proof to try and prove gross misconduct against an officer who has been acquitted and not seen to have acted unlawfully is going to appear to police officers as grossly unfair.
So do you want a review into this case to restore faith for officers overall?
Well, not just for officers. I mean, also for the black community to have faith in policing, that they're not being over-policed and under-protected. We need to build that trust as well. So neither side at the moment seems to have faith in the criminal justice system. That is a serious problem for the Home Secretary. It's a serious problem for the most senior police officer in the country,
yes,
and his colleagues. So an independent review of the decision-making in this system and how the process of holding the police to account worked that is open to both sides would be incredibly important in this case.
Neil Bazu, thank you for that.
Couple of minutes to eight. Women's Hour coming up this morning at 10 to tell us more. Nilla McGovern is here in the studio. Morning, Nilla.
Good morning. Well, today we are dedicating the entire show to a phone-in programme on special educational needs and disabilities. We continue our extensive coverage on this issue. We're going to be discussing SEND provision in educational settings with a focus on what is working. So we want to hear from you about the best practice in your schools and nurseries. What's going well? We want the success stories, the good ideas, the concepts that can be passed on, scaled up, or that should be rolled out. The number 03700 100 444 from 10.
Oh, I'll be listening. It's lovely to see you in the studio.
Good to see you too.
Former birth there at Women's Hour, Nilla. Let's get the weather from Simon King.
Thanks, Emma. Yeah, it's fog this morning that we need to be aware of, and it's particularly dense across parts of southwest England, southeastern, eastern England, and across the Midlands. Visibility is really quite low at the moment. Now, the fog should tend to lift up and clear away, but for parts of Lincolnshire and East Anglia, the fog could linger on to mid to late morning, so taking a little while before it clears away completely. We've got a few showers around the south coast of England today as well, and maximum temperatures getting up to about 15 to 17 degrees. For Wales, northwest and northeast England, one or two mist and fog patches, especially around the Vale of York. Otherwise, though, some clear skies and some sunshine through today, some areas of cloud, small possibility of a shower in northwest England, highs of 12 to 14, and across Scotland and Northern Ireland, we've got some cloudy skies in northern and western areas, a few spots of rain here as well. That should tend to ease off. The cloud breaks up, there'll be some sunny spells, especially for Northern Ireland, southern and eastern Scotland, temperatures 12 to 14 degrees. But locally, 16 or 17 degrees Celsius around the Murray Firth.
Simon, thank you very much. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb. It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 23rd of October. The headlines this morning: Labour has been accused by Donald Trump's team of blatant interference in the US presidential election and illegally funding his opponent's campaign. A review of the water industry is to consider the future of the regulator Ofwat, but not renationalisation. And trials for the first vaccine of the winter vomiting bug, norovirus, are to be carried out across the UK.
And coming up in the next hour, our US editor hosts a roundtable with the Arab American voters in one swing state, which could help decide the presidential election.
I'm not just voting for Trump. I am endorsing him and telling my community to vote for him as well.
But you've been a Democrat all your life?
I'm still a Democrat. Actually, probably left, more left than most Democrats.
And the orchestra, where the key instrument is, love this, bubble wrap.
I don't necessarily pop much. And I never wanted to pop it, even as a kid. I do understand everyone wants to, so I sort of save it for dramatic moments.
Finally, an orchestra I'm qualified to join, Justin. The BBC News is read by Charles Carroll.
Donald Trump's presidential campaign has taken the extraordinary step of filing a legal complaint against the Labour Party, accusing it of blatantly interfering in the American election. The six-page letter cites a now-deleted social media post in which Labour members were encouraged to travel to the US to campaign for the Democrats. In a statement, Mr. Trump's team claims the party has inspired what it calls Kamala Harris's dangerously liberal policies and rhetoric. Sir Keir Starmer says Labour activists were volunteering in their own time. Our political editor, Chris Mason, has more.
The complaint from the Trump campaign is both pointed and theatrical. When representatives of the British government previously sought to go door-to-door in America, it did not end well for them. A matter-of-fact reference to US independence around 250 years ago. To matters more contemporary, it requests an immediate investigation into what it calls blatant foreign interference. Sir Keir Starmer said Labour had volunteers who'd gone to America pretty much every election, and they were doing it in their spare time and staying with other volunteers. Asked if it risked jeopardising his relationship with Donald Trump, he said no, pointing to the dinner the two men had together at Trump Tower in New York last month. We established a good relationship, the Prime Minister said.
Chris Ruddy is the chief executive of the right-wing media organisation Newsmax and a close friend of Donald Trump. He told us that there were two problems with Labour activists campaigning in the United States.
One is that the Labour Party is officially supporting the idea of sending volunteers over to work on a partisan Democratic campaign. And then second, there's a perception that perhaps the government may be interfering. It may be more of a perception problem than a legal one. But obviously, if you send campaign workers and somebody's paying them food or housing or supporting their ability, that's considered a campaign expenditure.
An independent commission is to examine how to improve the water industry, as companies face criticism for awarding bonuses to shareholders and sometimes dumping sewage into rivers while increasing bills. The review will be led by Sir John Cunliffe, the former Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, and will consider options such as abolishing the regulator Ofwat. On this programme, the Environment Secretary Steve Reid was pressed on whether he believed the watchdog was working effectively.
There are certainly very severe failures of regulation and governance that underpin the problems that we're seeing in the water sector. And what I've asked Sir John to do is look from the bottom up at the whole sector. Now, that will include regulation and the regulator, but I'm not going to predict what he might come up with because that is for him.
Hezbollah says that it has struck an Israeli army intelligence base near Tel Aviv. Sirens sounded around the city. The Israeli military said two long-range missiles were successfully intercepted and there were no injuries or damage. The army has issued an urgent evacuation order to residents of the southern Lebanese city of Tyre ahead of airstrikes against what it said were Hezbollah targets. Before leaving Israel for Saudi Arabia, the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said that some progress had been made, but not enough, in talks with the Israeli government about getting more aid into Gaza. Britain and Germany will today sign what the government here is calling a landmark defence agreement aimed at boosting security, investment and jobs. Under the plans, the German arms maker Rheinmetall will open a new factory in the UK to produce barrels for artillery guns, and German maritime surveillance aircraft will also fly patrols from RAF Lossiemouth in Scotland. Our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale, reports.
This is part of a wider push by this government to strengthen relations with key European allies post-Brexit. The UK already has a defence pact with France, but this is the first with Germany. The Defence Secretary, John Healey, called it historic.
It brings our UK and German militaries closer together, our industries closer together, both to strengthen our security and Europe's security.
In reality, Germany and the UK already cooperate as NATO allies and in a joint venture, they're already making new armoured vehicles for the British Army. But the German defence giant Rheinmetall will also build a factory in the UK to manufacture barrels for artillery guns. It'll use British steel and support 400 jobs. There's a commitment to jointly develop new long-range missiles and drones and to bolster NATO's eastern flank.
A new vaccine to protect people from the winter vomiting bug is to be trialled in the UK this winter. The trial of the Moderna norovirus jab will involve thousands of people in more than six countries over the next 2 years. Nearly 4 million people in the UK are infected every year, which costs the NHS roughly £100 million. The co-clinical lead for the National Institute for Health and Care Research, Professor Saul Faust, gave this programme more details of the trial.
This is a trial of 25,000 people globally. We hope 10% of that number will come from the UK. That's about 2,500 people. And we are looking for some younger people to take part in the trial who are in at-risk groups, so healthcare workers, childcare providers and so on, people who work in care homes. But the majority of people who take part will be over 60.
One of the UK's leading experts on vaccines has called for an overhaul of payments for those injured by immunisations. Professor Adam Finn from Bristol University says the current government scheme is arbitrary and the payouts are too low. The COVID vaccination programme is credited with preventing more than 100,000 deaths. Nearly 25 million adults had at least one dose of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Here's our medical editor, Fergus Walsh.
188 payouts have been made under the Vaccine Damage Payment Scheme for serious complications of COVID jabs. All but a handful of awards relate to the AstraZeneca vaccine, which triggered a rare type of blood clot which could be fatal. Payments are fixed at £120,000, an amount which hasn't increased since 2007. 253 people have been told that while it's accepted that they were harmed by the AstraZeneca jab, they don't meet the threshold of 60% disability and therefore are not entitled to a payment. Some claimants have waited more than 2 years for an assessment. Professor Finn said the scheme appeared arbitrary and he warned it risked undermining confidence in vaccination. The government says it will look closely at the concerns of affected families. A group of around 50 people are taking separate legal action for compensation against AstraZeneca. The company said it couldn't comment on ongoing litigation.
And you can watch the full story, COVID vaccine fighting for a payout, on iPlayer now. A man has been charged with the murder of a woman who was attacked while walking her dog in Suffolk in July. Anita Rose, who was 57, was found with serious head injuries near the village of Brantham and died 4 days later in hospital. Roy Barclay, who's 55, was arrested on Monday and will appear in court later. In the past hour, King Charles and Queen Camilla have arrived on the Pacific island of Samoa for a 4-day visit. The king will preside for the first time over a gathering of Commonwealth leaders, with Sir Keir Starmer among those attending. The monarch is also expected to be given the honorary title of High Chief during a traditional Samoan ceremony. A unique marine research vessel from the 1960s, which was able to flip from horizontal to vertical in 20 minutes, could be making a comeback. The floating platform was used by US Navy scientists before being decommissioned last year. Now a team of marine engineers in Bristol wants to give it a new lease of life, as our science correspondent Helen Briggs explains.
The floating instrument platform, or FLIP, was one of the strangest research vessels ever built. More than 100 metres long, it regularly sank beneath the ocean off California in the name of scientific research. When partly flooded with water, the floating platform could flip up into a vertical position, allowing scientists to make precise measurements at sea. And after 60 years of service, she was retired and towed to Mexico to be scrapped. But when the Bristol-based marine engineering company Deep heard about it, they set about rescuing her, shipping her to France for a refit. They hope to bring the FLIP into service again by the end of the decade for future research beneath the waves and the bold mission of enabling humans to live and work underwater for long periods of time.
And that was Helen Briggs reporting.
Thank you. 8:10 is the time. By this time in the morning, in 2 weeks' time, we might know who has won. We might not. The voting in America's presidential election will have finished, but the counting could well be carrying on for hours, if not days, if it is close. And all the suggestions are that it is close, so close that a very small swing in opinion in one or two states could propel Donald Trump or Kamala Harris to the White House. One of those states is Michigan, traditional home of the nation's car industry, but also a place with a large population of Muslim Americans, many of them originally from the Middle East, and many of them deeply affected by what's happening in the Middle East now. We're going to hear from some in a moment. They've been talking to our North America editor, Sarah Smith. But when I talked to her earlier, we began with the row between the Trump campaign and Labour that has seen Trump's people making an official complaint of election interference.
Well, what the Trump campaign is alleging is that somehow or other, the Labour Party is making illegal campaign donations to the Harris-Waltz campaign. And it is against the law for foreign nationals to come and campaign in America if they're being paid to do so, if there's any money involved. Now, it doesn't seem that that is the case here at all, that these are individuals who've taken leave from their jobs, who are paying their own expenses. The suggestion that housing would be sorted for them seems to be simply that Democrat volunteers in some key swing states will, you know, arrange accommodation to stay with some other campaign volunteers. So it's extremely unlikely there is actually a campaign violation here. But it's a fascinating window, isn't it, into how the Trump campaign sees the Labour Party. In this letter that they have sent to the electoral watchdog, they describe it as the far left Labour Party, and they blame them for inciting dangerously radical rhetoric from Kamala Harris. So although it is perfectly normal, in fact, for Labour volunteers to come over here and work for the Democrats and vice versa, just as it's perfectly normal for British Conservatives to be in America campaigning for Republicans and vice versa. I think this is a much more important story about what Trump thinks of Keir Starmer and his Labour government and what that might mean for their relationship if Donald Trump is to be re-elected as the US president.
Mm. OK, let us turn to Michigan, important swing state, and the interviews that you've been conducting with some Arab Americans in that state. Tell us why they matter potentially so much in that state and then what they've been saying.
Well, as you say, it is a key swing state. It voted for Donald Trump in 2016, and then Joe Biden flipped it in 2020, and he won here by just over 150,000 votes. Well, there are over 300,000 Arab American voters in this state, and many of them are absolutely furious with the Biden-Harris administration, really angry that the president and his vice president haven't put more pressure on Israel to rein in its attacks on Gaza and now Lebanon. And it's interesting, when I was talking to people here, just how much they hold Kamala Harris responsible for America's foreign policy, just as much as they do Joe Biden. And so, I mean, quite deliberately, we gathered together a group of lifelong Democrats, and I met them in a cafe in Dearborn, Michigan. And these are people who would normally be out campaigning for the Democratic candidate for president. But instead of doing that, they're all agonizing about how to vote. And when I spoke to them all, it was fascinating, the different decisions that they've come to, some of which were, I mean, really genuinely surprising about who they say that they're prepared to support.
Can you tell us how you'll vote in November?
I'm not just voting for Trump. I am endorsing him and telling my community to vote for him as well.
But you've been a Democrat all your life?
I'm still a Democrat. Actually, probably left, more left than most Democrats.
So why on earth vote for Donald Trump and encourage others to do it?
Because I believe there has to be accountability for over 250,000 lives lost. I do not forgive the Democrats for it, and I will not be scared into voting for them.
Teddy, has Mara convinced you yet to vote for Donald Trump?
Not really. She might have persuaded me a little bit, but if I have to vote my conscience, I would definitely not vote for Trump. If I do want to punish the Democrats, specifically this administration, then I might have to consider that.
Before the October 7th attacks last year, could you have possibly imagined you'd ever be considering voting for Trump?
The short answer is no. I did not vote for him in the past two elections. I never thought myself could consider a 10% chance to even vote for Trump.
And now you really are thinking about it.
Every time I say it, I feel I'm going to choke because my conscience will come up and I feel like I have to go throw up right now for saying that. But also, I think about my family, my people in Palestine and in Lebanon. I'm a Palestinian who was born and grew up in Lebanon.
So what would you have wanted the Biden-Harris administration to do to try and stop Israel bombing Lebanon?
All it takes is one phone call. The president of the United States, he is the most powerful person on this planet. We supply them with all the weapons. We fund the state of Israel. We give them the money.
Joe Biden obviously has been setting most of this policy. Do you blame Kamala Harris for America's policy towards Israel in the Middle East?
I think it's hard to blame a person, but I do blame the administration. I blame a process and a party that has allowed for this to persist.
Thank you. Have you decided how you'll be voting in the election?
I'm a lifelong, not only Democrat voter, but also Democrat organizer and mobilizer. I will vote Harris, but I will not have the energy or the audacity knocking doors on my Muslim community and tell them to vote for Harris.
Will you actually cast a vote for Kamala Harris, or will you vote against her?
I might just leave it blank.
All right, so you don't want to vote for Kamala Harris, but you won't vote for Donald Trump.
I will not vote for Donald Trump. Donald Trump is the one who instituted the Muslim ban. Donald Trump moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. He gave the Golan Heights to Israel as if it was his grandfather's, and he gave him a quit claim deed. I will not vote for him, no.
What about Sam's point about the Muslim ban, about moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem?
There's no greater insult to me as a Yemeni American woman than to tell me I don't understand what a Trump presidency is going to be like in terms of my women's rights, in terms of what may happen to people coming from my home country. I understand that, but I've lived through 4 years of Trump. And unfortunately, 250,000 Palestinians and Lebanese people have not lived through even 1 year of Biden at this point. So I'm not going to be scared out of holding an administration accountable for what they're doing and what they've done.
So what do you think when you hear people like Samara saying they're going to vote for Trump?
I'm worried. I am worried. I respect my people's decision and my community's decision, and I feel it. But as someone Muslim, as someone, a woman who look visibly Muslim and Arab, I definitely don't want to live another cycle under Trump, not only because of Muslim ban, but because of the things that he's promising to do if he gets elected again.
Listening to what people are saying, you must be realizing there's a significant chance you'll wake up and find that Donald Trump has been reelected president. How do you feel about that?
If I do find that come the day of election, the next day he's president, I think we'll be fearful. But, you know, the reality is that many Americans, many Arab Americans are living in a state of fear right now because we're losing our loved ones. We're hearing about the stories. So can it be any worse? I mean, that's a question we're trying to grapple with.
They kept telling us Donald Trump is the biggest threat to our democracy. If you think Mr. Biden, the administration that's in the White House right now, if you think he's the biggest threat to our administration, and don't hold us responsible, okay, the Arab American community, if Donald Trump gets elected.
A group of Arab Americans, Democratic Party supporters, at least in the past, talking to Sarah Smith. And listening to that was John Zogby, himself an American of Lebanese descent, also one of the nation's best known independent pollsters. Do those views comport with the type of things he's hearing?
It indeed does. Now, to be sure, there are some Democrats who, for local reasons, that is Democratic Arab Americans, for local reasons, are still probably going to vote Democrat. But the anger and the intensity of the anger is palpable. And what you just heard were five party activists with the same level of intensity. These, for want of a better word, are not only activists, but they're also influencers. That sentiment in Dearborn and Wayne County, Macomb County, where the large concentrations of Arab Americans are, could really make a difference in Michigan.
Really? You think it could make the difference between Kamala Harris winning and losing? Is it as serious for her as that?
Well, Michigan is close right now. It's competitive, as Sarah pointed out. In the interview, Michigan has been a swing state. This year, it's not going to take that many votes. It could take a few hundred or even a few thousand to swing victory one way or another. Remember, Arab Americans are about 5% of the total vote in Michigan, and that is a number that looms pretty large.
Yeah, and there's a YouGov poll, not just of Michigan, but actually a national poll this week, which has suggested actually as many as half of Arab Americans more generally are going to vote for Donald Trump. And I suppose the issue there is that quite a few of them might vote for him for economic reasons or other reasons. It's not necessarily about what's going on at the moment between Israel and Hamas.
Well, there are Arab American Republicans, and there is disaffection because of the economy and because of the southern border and so on. But by and large, in our national polling of Arab Americans, you know, we find that Gaza is a very important issue, and there is a lot of anger, particularly among those who are still in the immigrant stage.
And yet, what the Harris campaign presumably would say is that just looking at this in political terms, never mind the morality one way or the other, but in political terms, had they done what these people want them to do, which is essentially cut off funding to Israel, there would have been a huge backlash among Jewish Americans, but also more widely among Americans who support Israel. In other words, the politics of this, it might be tricky in Michigan, but the politics of this is not clear.
It's a conundrum that she faces, because on one hand, we have found in our polling of Arab Americans that if she were to use American aid as a leverage for a ceasefire, to demand an immediate ceasefire, 40% would be more likely to support her, only 4 or 5% less likely. That is a mirror of the national U.S. voters that we found just recently in early October. In terms of Jewish Americans, right now, she has, according to one poll, 71% who say they're going to vote for her, 26% are going to vote for Donald Trump. So the risk for her is not as large as one thinks. The Jewish vote is basically a liberal vote, and it's not going to vote for Donald Trump or shift that much.
Although I suppose we thought that about Arab Americans, didn't we?
Well, we did, but Arab Americans are on the receiving end of some pretty bad stuff. In Dearborn, in particular, in the immigrant communities in particular, you have people who have relatives in Gaza, now in southern Lebanon, for that matter, even in northern Lebanon and in Christian bastions, who, if not killed or maimed, can hear the bombs, including, to be very honest with you, my own family.
A final thought about the wider race, John. There seems to be a sense that Kamala Harris is to an extent becalmed and that Trump has the momentum. Is that a fair view, do you think?
It is a fair view, but let's be very careful here. It shifted a point or two in Donald Trump's favor, which is enough to give him a faux lead, 1 or 2 percentage points. It could swing back next week, but she faces this conundrum on foreign policy, but she also faces even a bigger one, holding together an unholy alliance of disaffected Republicans who don't want Donald Trump but are having a hard time warming up to voting for a Democrat, progressive Democrats who are really angry about the war in the Middle East, and then mainstream Democrats, usual Democratic voters, but who understand that they're backing a pretty unpopular administration.
John Zogby, thank you very much for talking to us.
Well, at 24 minutes past eight, let's turn our attention to something different. And let me ask you a question. What do you think of the idea of compulsory cognitive assessments for drivers over the age of 80? I'm asking because a Scottish judge has called for it as a matter of priority. And their call follows a crash which killed a toddler involving a 91-year-old who had dementia but held a full driver's licence at the time. Dame Joan Bakewell, Labour peer, journalist and former voice of older people for the government, is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
I believe you are in your 90s and still driving. What do you make of this call? Yes.
I am driving. I drive daily and I take pleasure in it. I think I'm a good driver, but I would certainly be willing to submit to any kind of test to make sure that I was safe on the road. I think that's a good idea.
And yet some people would be very resistant to this. Do you understand the idea of, for the very reasons you've championed older people, they don't want to seem just on the basis of their age that they are diminished in any way?
Well, and the point is, it's unavoidable that certain skills decline as you get older. I'm conscious that my memory isn't as good as it was, and I take steps to do something about it. I write notes, I keep memos everywhere. The point is, you do have to acknowledge that age brings change, even though you regret it and you struggle against it. So I think it's a matter of compromise in terms of your own cognitive ability. And if society wants to check you out, in the interests of the safety of other people, I think that's a legitimate claim.
I mean, there are some checks at the moment, but this is talking about a cognitive ability. What do you have to do at the moment to prove you can still drive?
I think when I was 70, I had a test to make sure that I could. I think you have to be aware yourself. I think that every time you take an MOT and generally submit to your car to your garage, people should be aware that there's an exchange going on between those who monitor your car and those who monitor its driver. So I do think you have to watch as you get older. You can't go on driving year after year after year and not recognize that there are changes happening in your brain, your physical ability, your mobility in able to brake quickly, to recognize traffic around you, to overtake cautiously. All sorts of detail about driving need immediate response, very quick response, particularly in a bad traffic situation. So I think it's legitimate to check that you're up to these.
And I suppose that the bigger question again is if you lost, not just you, if somebody older lost their ability to be able to drive, and perhaps they hadn't realised some of those things weren't quite where they should be, it could lead to a smaller life, and that can be the fear. And I wonder what you would say about the importance for you and for perhaps some of your friends of still having that ability.
Oh, I rely on my car a great deal. I depend on it. I zoom around in it. I go into the House of Lords.
Not too fast, that's the point.
And not too fast. On the other hand, and I enjoy driving. I sometimes go out for what my mother called a little spin in the car, simply for the pleasure of it. So it matters a very great deal. And I would feel I'd lost a limb if I wasn't able to drive my car. So cars matter, and they matter a great deal to old people who live in the country.
Yes.
Because people who live in the country are really isolated, and that really matters in terms of their well-being, their sense of security, their place in the world. If you live in the country and you're isolated, you're in a bad way.
Yes, and also that sense of whether you still feel you can go out or not. People's worlds can become a lot smaller, a lot quicker with certain measures that perhaps, you know, unintended consequences.
Yes, I mean, an arm is a car is a limb of your life, really. And without it, you are diminished. So it's important that old people are helped to keep driving, to check, of course. They've got to be safe on the road. They might have to learn to stay in particular lanes, to take routes that are not too dangerous. But I think they need help in continuing to be drivers well into late years, rather than simply dismissed as not up to the standards of young, you know, bright and breezy young drivers.
Dame Jane Boakwell, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Hubble State's time. Let's turn to Mike and the sport.
3 wins out of 3 for Aston Villa in the Champions League. They beat Bologna 2-0 last night to move to the top of the table. Arsenal were also 1-0 winners against Shakhtar Donetsk. Celtic are amongst the British clubs in action later this evening. And we are now going to hear from one of the great characters of Scottish football. Ali McCoist played 61 times for Scotland, including at 2 major tournaments, scoring 19 goals, and he's now written a book called Dear Scotland. Well, I spoke to Ali earlier and started by asking his motivation for writing what has been described as a love letter to the national side.
Well, I just think after the contrasting Scotland performances in the Euros, and that being like the performances on the pitch were poor, but the performance off the pitch from the fans was world class. And it's always fascinated me being A, a Scotland fan, and then B, a Scotland player, and then C, a Scotland coach. So I can see it from all angles. It's a fascinating journey. I mean, it must be heck of a boring if you're a Brazilian fan, because you know your team are going to be brilliant. You'll be a great watch. Whereas with Scotland, you know there is going to be disappointment somewhere along the line. I don't think any Scotland fan, including myself, would swap any of the journeys we've been on.
You're absolutely right. The first week, 10 days of the Euros this summer was just defined, wasn't it, by the colour and the vibrancy of the travelling Scotland fans in the hundreds of thousands out in Germany, the Tartan Army representing. And you point out in the book, don't you, that from 1974, Scotland qualified for six of the next seven World Cups before this long World Cup hiatus from 1998 that still continues to this day, doesn't it? What was it about that period in the 70s, 80s and 90s that was so special for Scotland?
Do you know what it was, Mike? I think it's pretty plain and straightforward. We just had an incredible talent on the pitch. We really did, from the 74 squad, you know, which included Dennis Law and Billy Bremner, Davy Hay. I still close my eyes and I can see that ball coming off wee Billy Bremner's shin in a nothing each draw against Brazil that should have gone in. That's a kind of my first kind of memory of supporting Scotland. And then you go into 78 in Argentina, the Ali McLeod story, 82 in Spain, Big Jock Steen, 86 after the tragic death of Big Jock when Fergie took us in 1990, my own World Cup that I went to in Italy, which was an absolutely wonderful experience.
And there's actually quite a strongly worded ending to the book, isn't it? Where you're critical of those people who you say are just happy to settle for qualifying. You admonish those who say, well, haven't they done well for just being here? You believe that Scotland players and fans should have higher expectations.
I do. I genuinely do. You look at countries like Croatia, for example, and the Dutch. The Dutch have produced numerous world-class sides and aren't one of the biggest nations. So it is great to get to these tournaments. But I'm now at the stage, Mike, come on, let's qualify for the latter stages of one. We should be aiming high. I'm ready to go that next step. We're all ready to go that next step, Mike.
So what about the next World Cup, Ali? 18 months or so away.
Oh.
Can Steve Clarke and this current crop of Scotland players end that near 30-year wait to qualify for a World Cup finals?
Yes, they can. The level of performance since Germany has greatly improved, and that gives me hope, because we must qualify for this World Cup in Mexico, USA and Canada. I mean, there's every chance that half the Tartan Army won't come home if we qualify. I mean, there'll be people missing in Mexico, northern Mexican cities drinking tequila and things like that in Canada, west coast of Canada. Half the Tartan Army won't come home, but what a journey it'll be, what a trip it'll be.
What a road trip, you're absolutely right. Just turning briefly to domestic issues, Ali. This season in Scotland is the 40th anniversary of any team other than Celtic or Rangers winning the league. Sir Alex Ferguson's Aberdeen, of course, were champions in 1985. Yeah. Since then, it's been four decades of dominance from the two big Glasgow clubs. Will this stranglehold that the old firm have in the league ever be broken, do you think?
It will, eventually. Not this year, I don't think. Sadly, from my point of view, being a Rangers man, expect Celtic to win the league. And there's nothing that I've seen to the contrary, other than my own concern that Aberdeen have this season got a better chance of splitting the old firm than any team has for a good number of years. But if you're asking me, can they take this next step and win the title? What it's going to take is you have to go to Glasgow and win. That's what Fergie's team did. That's the biggest stumbling block. And I don't mean one-off, Mike. I don't mean a one-off game, because that can happen. For any team, whether it's Aberdeen, whether it's Hearts or Hibs, they have to take their form to Glasgow. And I don't see it happening at this moment in time.
Well, Ali, we could talk all morning, but I just want to end, actually, with a couple of two-word answers. Best Scotland player you ever played with?
Do you know something? It has to be Kenny Dalglish, and sadly for me, it wasn't long enough.
And you might be repeating the same answer here, but in your opinion, best Scotland player of all time?
There's been some good ones, mine. Dennis Law, Graham Souness, Jim Baxter. I'll stick with Kenny.
And I don't think many people would disagree with that. Great to speak to Ali McCoist. His new book, Dear Scotland, On the Road with the Tartan Army, is out now.
Mike, thanks very much for that. Coming up at 9 here on Radio 4. Don't go anywhere. It's More or Less. Tim Harford's going to tell us some more.
This week, was an MP wrong about the number of people who pay capital gains tax? Why does the Bank of England try to ensure inflation is 2%? Why not zero? Donald Trump says US crime figures are fake. Are they? We fact-check a claim about the prevalence of suicide among GPs. And with the help of an expert, we comb through piles of bear excrement. That's More or Less with me, Tim Harford, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds in half an hour.
To the weather, there is mist and fog. It will go, then it'll be largely dry and fine. Spells of sunshine.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnes. It's 25 to 9. Let's get a summary of the news from Charles Carroll.
The Environment Secretary Steve Reed has told this programme that Labour has nothing to do with party members going to America to campaign for Kamala Harris. He was responding to accusations from Donald Trump's campaign team that Labour is blatantly interfering in the US presidential election. The Lebanese armed group Hezbollah says that it has struck an army intelligence base near Tel Aviv. Sirens sounded around the city in central Israel. The Israeli army said two long-range missiles were successfully intercepted and no injuries or damage resulted from the attack. Britain and Germany will today sign what the government is calling a landmark defence agreement aimed at boosting security, investment and jobs. The plans are part of a wider push by the government to reset relations with key European allies post-Brexit. And a vaccine is to be tested on 25,000 people in several countries, including the UK, to find out if it could protect against the winter vomiting bug norovirus. If successful, researchers say that it would reduce the number of vulnerable adults in hospital.
Thanks very much, Charles. The government is launching then this independent review into the water industry. We've been talking about this throughout the programme, following public outcry over bills, bonuses and sewage pollution. In a moment, I'll talk to David Henderson, the chief executive of Water UK. That's the umbrella organisation for the water companies. But first, we want to return to the River Avon, a river we've been following for a while now. Charlotte Sawyer is the director of the Avon River documentary and a member of the Conham Bathing Group in Bristol. She and her friend Ava have started testing the water quality themselves. Yesterday, they sent us this postcard.
I'm just walking to the river at Conham River Park, which is in Bristol, and it's a stunning spot set in between two quite densely residential parts of Bristol, really nice parts of Bristol, but lots of traffic, lots of concrete. But then you come a bit down the hill and walk around the riverside path to collect a sample to test the river, and then also meet my friend Aggie for a swim. This particular patch of the Avon is a calm, beautiful oasis. I mean, I can just hear birds, and I can hear trees, and I can hear myself think it is so stunning, and that's why I really want to protect it. Or this kind of metal clanging is a pole that I've got with me to collect a sample. It's kind of got a long extendable bit so that you can get as far into the middle of the river as possible to get a representative sample. When Aggie comes, we're going to test the water for bacteria that indicates sewage pollution, E. coli, and also nitrates and phosphates. We've got to drop that off at a proper lab, which is Wessex Water's lab. So results that we had in September, we had some awful results, some of the worst that we've had in a long time. I got really sick when I swam after a rainy day.
Hello.
You okay?
Yeah, good.
If you wouldn't mind collecting the sample.
That's how you tip it over. And then I've got my sample. Cover the lid and it's good to go.
Right, let's get in.
Let's get in.
Ooh. Oh my gosh. Oh. Oh. Just so beautiful just to see a heron just glide past in the mist. Like when you see the mist, there's mist collecting. Oh, it's so beautiful.
Yeah. Good swim.
Good swim.
Charlotte and Aggie there, sorry, not Ava as I was saying, but listening to that, David Henderson, the chief executive of Water UK, that umbrella organisation for the water companies, as we have been hearing all morning, the government launching an independent review into the water industry, the biggest actually since privatisation in the 80s. David, are you ashamed that that step has to be taken by the government?
We welcome it. It's clear the system is not working. The system is very complicated, it's very expensive, and it's far too slow. It takes over 14 months for investment plans to be approved. They take over 53,000 pages, and they cost companies over $200 million. That's such a waste of time and money. So we very much want this review to look at all of the reasons that are causing that and to come up with concrete proposals to change it, because we cannot keep persisting with a system where your postcard just revealed people are not able to enjoy the environment as they should be able to.
What about taking responsibility, though, the water companies itself? Because, if we look at unresolved complaints to water firms from households. That's not a system problem, is it? That's a company problem. They've risen by almost a third this year concerning sewage spills, billing mistakes and problems with water meters.
We as an industry have put our hand up. We accept that performance has not been where it should be. We've apologised for that. But this is a much more comprehensive review. It's looking at not just companies, the regulators, the legislative apparatus, the entire system, because the whole system is not working. We have failed as a country to invest, not just in water, but particularly in water, for at least 15 years.
While that might be the case, your apology, do you think people really have accepted it, know about it and believe it?
Well, we have a plan. As I say, it's before the regulator. Because of the rules that have been imposed on us, it's taken over 14 months for the regulator to look at those plans, and it's taken us 53,000 pages. It's too complicated and slow. The system is not delivering what people want. It's costing too much money.
Well, hang on, because you may have a plan, but we've also, you know, only cast our mind back to last week. The BBC revealed a water company, United Utilities, repeatedly dumped millions of litres of raw sewage illegally into Windermere, one of England's most famous lakes, across 3 years. It failed to report most of it. United Utilities said some of its sewage releases were potentially non-compliant, but it self-reports over 94% of potential pollution incidents to the Environment Agency. Is that in the plan?
The plan is absolutely looking at trying to end sewage flowing into all waterways across the whole of England and Wales.
Why did that happen?
It's happened because we've had a failure of investment. The regulator has prevented us from investing as we should have, which is why water bills have been falling year after year after year. They are now a quarter lower than they would be if they'd merely risen with inflation. And the direct consequence of that failure to invest has been an environment that is not coping, and increasingly an economy too. We're not being able to build the houses that we need. Even a cancer hospital in Cambridge was held up for no other reason than a lack of water. This is becoming increasingly serious for our country.
It's hard though, isn't it, with dividends and how they've been paid and the millions going to water bosses and then seeing leaks and stories that are being followed up by the BBC and exposed like that. To believe what you're saying all comes down to the system not working, the regulator not doing its job. What about properly taking responsibility?
Well, as I said, we have apologised for performance not being where it should be. You've spoken about
dividends.
Where's
that apology? What does it mean?
Well, and it's been accompanied with an action plan. And the plan is before the regulator.
To charge people more?
Only investment will be authorised if it is new, necessary and value for money. And if the companies don't spend it as it should, they should, it will be refunded to customers.
Why should people want to pay water companies anymore when you give them sometimes incorrect bills, they hear about illegal dumping, and then they don't have good customer service? The water companies that you represent have nothing stopping them right now from getting water bills accurate, from not illegally dumping sewage into lakes. You can blame Ofwat for lots of different things, as even the government have talked about this morning. But you very quickly move on from that apology. What about customers listening to this who cannot afford to pay anymore, do not want to pay anymore, and do not think that the water companies you represent deserve anymore?
Well, on customer complaints, the funding that enables call centres and other systems for billing to be operated has also been cut by the regulator. So the entire operations of companies is subject to the money that is enabled to be spent by the regulator. And that money's been falling year after year after year. And if you keep squeezing...
And bonuses with that?
So you could add up all the bonuses that have been paid since 1990 and you wouldn't get to half of 1% of what we need to spend for the next 5 years alone.
Would you expect people to believe, though, that it's... No, just 1 minute, I'm not disputing the rules, but do you expect people to believe that there couldn't have been decisions within companies to invest more in parts of those services that directly interface with the public?
Investment is authorised by the regulator and nobody else. Companies cannot invest any more than they're allowed to by the regulator.
So there's nothing these companies, these water companies that you represent, could have done any better?
No, as I say, we have apologised.
What have you apologised for, then?
For failing to keep up with the public expectation around this issue, particularly around sewage. We should have been
failing to keep... You are a water company and you've made water dirtier.
No, we haven't made water dirty.
I've just told you. I could go into more detail. We did it in detail last week. Millions of litres of raw sewage.
Yes, and it's millions fewer than they were about 10, 15 years ago. The quality of rivers has improved. We have beaches up sevenfold in terms of blue flag status and excellent rating. Nitrates and phosphorus are about two-thirds lower than they were 10, 15 years ago. The quality of water has been improving, but not fast enough. Nowhere near fast enough. And that is why we need to invest. Our system is crumbling.
That's the plan that you've...
Yes, I mean the government...
Well, it is detailed. You have said that. We'll get into that, I suppose, when the review begins, I hope, and we'll talk to you again. David Henderson, Chief Executive of Water UK. Thank you.
Thank you.
Time's a quarter to nine. Let's get the Lib Dem take on that and indeed on the budget that is happening in a week's time. Daisy Cooper, the deputy leader of the Liberal Democrats, is online. Morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you make of what you just heard?
I think that interview shows that the entire water company and its trade body do not have a leg to stand on. You know, I've been an MP for 5 years. I haven't received a single letter from a water company saying, you know what, it's so unfair, the regulator won't allow us to invest our money in fixing pipes. I haven't ever received a single letter like that. The fact of the matter is that these water companies have been paying out millions of pounds in big bonuses to their bosses. They've been paying out billions of pounds to shareholders as well. And they're asking the public and bill payers to pay for cleaning up the mess, cleaning up their mess. We Liberal Democrats have been leading on this campaign for years. We think that Ofwat is a busted flush. It needs to be replaced with a regulator that has teeth. We want to see an end to bonuses being paid until sewage dumping stops. And we want the companies to be reformed as well.
How do you keep shareholders or attract shareholders, future shareholders, into the industry, though, assuming you don't renationalise it?
We turn the water companies into responsible companies. And the way we do that is by turning them into public benefit companies. So we think it would be the wrong thing to do to nationalise these companies. It would take a long time and cost a huge amount of money for the taxpayer, which would not be acceptable. But if you transform them into public benefit companies, they continue to make profit, but they're required in law to meet their environmental principles before they can make profit. And that would enforce these companies to continue to be able to attract private investment, to keep their shareholders happy, but not at the expense of our environment or bill payers.
Right. Budget stuff now. What do you want to see in the budget? What would you like the emphasis of the Chancellor to be on?
Well, we have said that the NHS and care has to be the number one priority for this government and the number one priority for the budget. We know that if you have a healthy population and people are well enough to go back to work and access the care that they need, then that really gives a boost to the economy as well. So health and wealth are two sides of the same coin. And we do want to see the government make a bold commitment on fixing our crumbling hospitals, but also investing in primary care, in the GPs, the dentists, the pharmacists, the mental health experts and social care. All of those services that we really need to get our NHS back on its feet.
Paid for how?
Well, we think that it's completely acceptable for the government to borrow more to invest in fixing things like our crumbling hospitals and schools and prisons, because that is productive borrowing. But we do want to see the increase in day-to-day spending that we would like to see paid for by reversing the tax cuts on the big banks, by increasing taxes on the big tech companies and all the other big corporations that could afford to pay a modest amount more to get our public services back on their feet.
Daisy Cooper, Deputy Leader of the Liberal Democrats and Treasury spokesperson as well. Thank you.
Keeping with politics, but a different area at 12 minutes to nine, it's emerged this morning that the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, will vote against plans to change the law on assisted dying. Our Chief Political Correspondent, Henry Zeffman, has the stories back with us now. Henry, what do we know and why? What's the reason?
Emma, MPs will vote for the first time on November the 29th. On the legislation presented by Kim Leadbeater, a backbench Labour MP, which would change the law on assisted dying. That'll be the first time that MPs have voted on this issue since 2015, and they will be given what's known as a free vote, so no party instruction. Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, doesn't intend to get into the debate publicly, but we understand, and this was first reported by The Times, that on Monday he told a private meeting of Labour MPs that he would be voting against a change in the law. And in terms of his reasons, it is about his concerns about the quality of palliative care in this country. I mean, he spoke about this publicly when he said he was wrestling with how to vote. He said a few weeks ago that he worried that because of palliative care, end-of-life care in this country not being the state he would want it to be, that he worried that people wouldn't be given the freedom to choose, but they would feel, in his words, coerced by the lack of support available.
Henry, thank you very much for that. Henry Zeffman there with that news that the Health Secretary has made his decision. Wes Streeting, not going to get into it, but will vote against plans to change the law on assisted dying.
11 minutes to nine. Over the last two decades, a group of musicians has endeavoured to take classical music beyond the concert hall into less formal settings. New non-classical is the brainchild of Gabriel Prokofiev, grandson of Sergei Prokofiev. And now the London Symphony Orchestra is going to join forces with non-classical in a rare performance of a dozen living contemporary classical composers at the Hackney Empire in London. The world-renowned orchestra is going to play alongside contemporary instruments like the drum machine, record turntables, and even bubble wrap. Nicola Stanbridge has been finding out how this genre is growing in popularity.
Surrounded by an unusual array of instruments in his studio, composer Gabriel Prokofiev is assembling a landmark contemporary classical showcase, including his concerto for turntables.
My concept for that piece was to take phrases that the orchestra play and put them on the turntables, manipulate reversing, scratching, playing back new textures, and we even start to wonder what's turntables, what's orchestra. Interesting for classical music to be aware of things happening outside the classical world. Insisting that classical music can be performed outside concert halls keeps the classical music relevant to a wider part of the population. It means so much to work with an orchestra like the LSO, one of the greatest orchestras in the world, to be able to program a concert where all the composers are still alive.
On the programme is Tonia Coe, inspired by the experimentalism of American composer John Cage, and with a nod to plastics and the environment, she plays Bubble Wrap.
For the orchestra part, I decided to write it quite specifically so that the orchestra would be responding to the sounds that I made. However, for my own part, it's really quite free. I play bubble wrap as a friction instrument. I rub the bubble wrap with my hands. I don't necessarily pop much, and I never wanted to pop it, even as a kid. I do understand everyone wants to, so I sort of save it for dramatic moments.
Catherine McDowell is the managing director of the London Symphony Orchestra.
The piece that has always shocked people, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. I mean, there was a riot when that was first performed. Now it's a regular part of the repertoire. And what he did in extending what the instruments could do, the bassoonist who opens the Rite of Spring, at the time was thought to be unplayable, whereas now it's core repertoire. And I've really noticed quite a change, and certainly the work that Non-Classical and Gabriel has done has encouraged this, that it's been possible since the pandemic for us to program the occasional concert that is all contemporary music. I think it's also to do with what people are listening to on their phones. They pick from all different genres, and it's no longer as fixed as it used to be.
Performing with Non-Classical, the LSO will also play the first ever concerto for drum machine with composer Josephine Stevenson.
In my movement of the piece, I'm using the drum machine, the step sequencer. There'll be a pattern that's set and then that loops infinitely, changing which sounds are playing, which ones are muted, changing pattern. I really tried to fit the music of the orchestra around what's going on in the drum machine. Perhaps the most risky way, because if I do one thing wrong, potentially the whole thing crashes.
Can you see a time when drum machines become a more regular part of the orchestra?
Well, who knows? There have been periods over the centuries when the instruments of the orchestra did change and develop. It's really important that the composers, who are the visionaries in many ways, say, let's work in a new way. And it's important that an orchestra like the LSO remains open to all those possibilities.
There we go. Bubble wrap, drum machines, it's all going on. Don't say we don't bring you all life on the Today programme, but keep it here with us on Radio 4, because coming up at 9 after the news, Tim Harford will be investigating the numbers around US crime statistics, capital gains tax, and apparently grizzly bear diets. I can't tell you more than that, so you'll just have to listen. It's coming up after 9.
But before that, at 5 to 9, let us turn back to this row between Donald Trump's people, not the man himself, but his people, and the Labour Party, who they claim are illegally involving themselves in America's election by sending volunteers who maybe are getting some kind of compensation when they're there. Matthew McGregor is a former Labour activist. He advised Ed Miliband in his 2015 election campaign, and he volunteered for Barack Obama back in 2008, and indeed worked on his 2012 campaign as an American national. Good morning to you.
Morning.
Did you have anything paid for? Tell us the setup when you first go and what happens.
Yeah, this is something that a lot of activists do in the UK from all political parties and from other European countries and further afield. Really, you have to really work for it. You go, you pay for yourself to fly to America. You go and knock on the local Democratic campaign headquarters, and you just volunteer. It's not that much different from volunteering in the UK. You go and offer your time to join in those mundane activities that a campaign volunteer does. Go and knock on some doors. Go and take some leaflets and drop them off. Make some phone calls. It's kind of mundane, and a lot of activists do it simply because they love politics, and they love particularly American politics. And just being close to a campaign, being part of the campaign, is fun. It can be good fun. The activist in question talked about accommodation. What she's referring to is that Democratic activists will sometimes offer their spare room or even just their sofa to people who are coming in and volunteering their time. And
yes.
It really is less glamorous than it sounds.
Right, and that's important, isn't it? You're not being put up in the Ritz, which I think the kind of suggestion from the Trump campaign that somehow everything's been paid for, but in your experience, it wasn't.
Absolutely not. The most you can hope for is a bottle of Mountain Dew and some pretzels after you've done your leafleting.
What do Americans make of? I always wondered this when I saw people out there when I was based there for the BBC, and you see people campaigning who are very obviously British and sometimes with very marked English accents, campaigning, knocking on doors, etc. How are you generally received?
In two different ways. It's quite polarizing. Some people are quite put out by the idea of an outsider coming in and trying to tell them what to do. It's a lot of American pride in running their own affairs. But a lot of people are quite intrigued and quite delighted that people from far-flung countries care enough about their small town in the middle of Pennsylvania that they want to come over and be part of it. And there's a lot of affection, especially for English people. Americans love the English accent. They love English TV. There's lots of conversation points that you can make, lots of common ground. So you get as many people being really positive as you get people being critical.
I'm interested what you say about sometimes it being negative, because you do wonder whether this is what the Trump campaign is tapping into. And I don't know if you remember, 4 years before you were there, The Guardian intervened in the 2004 campaign. Do you remember this? It was in a place in Ohio, and they got people to write letters. Guardian readers wrote letters. I know this because I was sent there by the BBC. And actually, they were pretty annoyed, even ones who were intending to vote for John Kerry, which is what The Guardian wanted. It can backfire, can't it? And presumably that's the Trump campaign's hope this time round.
It absolutely can backfire. And obviously Trump in 2016 caught a lot of flack for the help that the Russian government was trying to give him and his campaign to get him elected. This idea of foreign interference is a big topic in American politics. And that's why they've done this political stunt today. The Labour Party activists in question are not breaking any rules, but the Trump campaign is making hay out of something. This is a very, very close election. There's 2 weeks to go. It is incredibly tight, and grabbing any piece of advantage is in their interest. That's what they're trying to do. But it's nothing more than a political stunt. It's obviously a political stunt that is going to create a headache for the Labour government here, but I think it's nothing.